This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents The Bands of Mourning, a Mistborn novel by Brandon Sanderson. Read for you by Michael Kramer. Prologue.
Telson!
Waxillium hissed as he crept out of the training hut. Glancing back, Telson winced and crouched lower. At 16, Waxillium's sister was 1 year older than he was. Her long dark hair framed a button nose and prim lips, and colorful V-shapes ran up the front of her traditional terrace robes. Those always seemed to fit her in a way his never did. On Telson they were elegant. Waxillium felt like he was wearing a sack.
"Go away, Asynthew,"
she said, inching around the side of the hut. "You're going to miss evening recitation."
"They won't notice I'm gone. They never check."
Inside the hut, Master Tellingdwar droned on about proper terrace attitudes. Submission, meekness, and what they called respectful dignity. He was speaking to the younger students. The older ones, like Waxillium and his sister, were supposed to be meditating. Telson scrambled away, moving through the forested area of Elendil, referred to simply as the village. Waxillium fretted, then hurried after his sister.
"You're going to get into trouble," he said once he caught up.
He followed her around the trunk of an enormous oak tree.
"You're going to get me into trouble."
"So," she said,
"what is it with you and rules, anyway?"
"Nothing," he said. "I just..." She stalked off into the forest. He sighed and trailed after her, and eventually they met up with three other terrace youths, two girls and a tall boy. Quarshim, one of the girls, looked Waxillium up and down. She was dark-skinned and slender.
"You brought him?"
"He followed me," Telson said.
Waxillium smiled at Quarshim hopefully, then at Ardashwi, the other girl. She had wide-set eyes and was his own age. And Harmony, she was gorgeous. She smiled at his attention, then glanced away, a demure smile on her lips.
"He'll tell on us,"
Quarshim said, drawing his attention away from the other girl.
"You know he will."
"I won't,"
Waxillium snapped. Quarshim gave Waxillium a glare.
"You might miss evening class.
We'll answer all the questions. It will be resting quiet in the classroom with nobody to fawn over the teacher."
Forch, the tall boy, stood just inside the shadows. Waxillium didn't look at Forch, didn't meet his eyes.
"He doesn't know, right? He can't know."
Forch was the oldest of them, but rarely said much. He was twin-born, like Waxillium. Not that either of them used their allomancy much these days. In the village, it was their terrace side, their ferrochemy, that was lauded. The fact that both he and Forch were coin shots didn't matter to the terrace.
"Let's go," Telson said. "No more arguing. We probably don't have much time. If my brother wants to tag along, then fine."
They followed her beneath the canopy, feet crackling on leaves. With this much foliage, you could easily forget you were in the middle of an enormous city. The sounds of shouting men and iron-shod hooves on cobbles were distant, and you couldn't see or smell the smoke in here. The terrace worked hard to keep their section of the city tranquil, quiet, peaceful. Waxillium should have loved it here. The group of five youths soon approached the Synod's Lodge, where the ranking terrace elders had their offices. Telson waved for the group of them to wait while she hurried up to a particular window to listen. Waxillium found himself looking about, anxious. Evening was approaching, the forest growing dim, but anyone could walk along and find them.
"Don't worry so much," he told himself.
He needed to join in their antics like his sister did. Then they'd see him as one of them, right? Sweat trickled down the sides of his face. Nearby, Quarshim leaned against a tree, completely unconcerned, a smirk growing on her lips as she noticed how nervous he was. Forge stood in the shadows, not crouching, but rusts. He could have been one of the trees for all the emotion he showed. Waxillium glanced at Ideshwi with her large eyes, and she blushed, looking away. Telson snuck back to them.
"She's in there." "That's our grandmother's office," Waxillium said.
"Of course it is," Telson said. "And she got called into our office for an emergency. Right, Ideshwi?"
The quiet girl nodded.
"I saw Elder Vwafendal running past my meditation room."
Quashim grinned.
"So she won't be watching."
"Watching what?" Waxillium asked.
"The Tin Gate," Quashim said. "We can get out into the city. This is going to be even easier than usual."
"Usual?"
Waxillium said, looking in horror from Quashim to his sister.
"You've done this before?"
"Sure,"
Telson said. "Hard to get a good drink in the village. Great pubs 2 streets over, though."
"You're an outsider," Forge said to him as he stepped up.
He spoke slowly, deliberately, as if each word required separate consideration.
"Why should you care if we leave?
Look, you're shaking.
What are you afraid of? You lived most of your life out there."
"You're an outsider," they said. Why was his sister always able to worm her way into any group? Why did he always have to stand on the outside?
"I'm not shaking," Waxillium said to Forge. "I just don't want to get into trouble."
"He's going to turn us in," Quashim said.
"I'm not."
"Not for this, anyway," Waxillium thought.
"Let's go,"
Telson said, leading the pack through the forest to the Tin Gate, which was a fancy name for something that was really just another street, though granted it had a stone archway etched with ancient terrace symbols for the 16 medals. Beyond it lay a different world. Glowing gas lamps marching along streets, newsboys trudging home for the night with unsold broadsheets tucked under their arms, workers heading to the rowdy pubs for a drink. He'd never really known that world. He'd grown up in a lavish mansion stuffed with fine clothes, caviar, and wine. Something about that simple life called to him. Perhaps he'd find it there, the thing he'd never found, the thing everyone else seemed to have but he couldn't even put a name to. The other 4 youths scuttled out, passing the building with shadowed windows where Waxillium and Telson's grandmother would usually be sitting and reading this time of night. The terrace didn't employ guards at the entrances to their domain, but they did watch. Waxillium didn't leave, not yet. He looked down, pulling back the sleeves of his robe to expose the metal-mined bracers he wore there.
"You coming?"
Telson called to him. He didn't respond.
"Of course you're not. You never want to risk trouble."
She led Forge and Quashim away. Surprisingly, though, Ideshwi lingered. The quiet girl looked back at him questioningly.
"I can do this," Waxillium thought. "It's nothing big."
His sister's taunt ringing in his ears, he forced himself forward and joined Ideshwi. He felt sick, but he fell in beside her, enjoying her shy smile.
"So, what was the emergency?" he asked Ideshwi.
"Huh?
The emergency that called grandmother away."
Ideshwi shrugged, pulling off her terrace robe, briefly shocking him until he saw that she wore a conventional skirt and blouse underneath. She tossed the robe into the bushes.
"I don't know much. I saw your grandmother running to the Synod Lodge, and overheard Tathid asking about it. Some kind of crisis. We were planning to slip out tonight, so I figured, you know, this would be a good time."
"But the emergency,"
Waxillium said, looking over his shoulder.
"Something about a constable captain coming to question her," Ideshwi said.
"A constable?"
"Let's go, Asinthew," she said, taking his hand. "Your grandmother is likely to make short work of the outsider. She could be on her way here already."
He'd frozen in place. Ideshwi looked at him. Those lively brown eyes made it hard for him to think.
"Come on," she urged. "Sneaking out is hardly even an infraction.
Didn't you live out here for 14 years?
Rusts. I need to go, he said, turning back to run toward the forest. Idashwi stood in place as he left her. Waxilium entered the woods, sprinting for the Synod Lodge.
You know she's going to think you're a coward now, part of him observed. They all will.
Waxilium skidded to the ground outside his mother's office window, heart thumping. He pressed against the wall, and yes, he could hear something through the open window.
We police ourselves, Grandmother Vwafendal said from inside. You know this.
Waxilium dared to push himself up, peeking in the window to see Grandmother seated at her desk, a picture of terrace rectitude, with her hair in a braid and her robes immaculate. The man standing across the desk from her held his constable's hat under his arm as a sign of respect. He was an older man with drooping mustaches, and the insignia on his breast marked him as a captain and a detective. High rank. Important. Yes, Waxilium thought, fiddling in his pocket for his notes.
The terrorists police themselves, the constable said, because they rarely need policing.
They don't need it now.
My informant...
So now you have an informant? Grandmother asked. I thought it was an anonymous tip.
Anonymous, yes,
the constable said, laying a sheet of paper on the desk.
But I consider this more than just a tip.
Waxilium's grandmother picked up the sheet. Waxilium knew what it said. He'd sent it, along with a letter to the constables in the first place. A shirt that smells of smoke, hanging behind his door. Muddied boots that match the size of the prints left outside the burned building. Flasks of oil in the chest beneath his bed. The list contained a dozen clues pointing to Forch, as the one who'd burned the dining lodge to the ground earlier in the month. It thrilled Waxilium to see that the constables had taken his findings seriously.
Disturbing, Grandmother said. But I don't see anything on this list that gives you the right to intrude upon our domain, Captain.
The constable leaned down to rest his hands on the edge of her desk, confronting her.
You weren't so quick to reject our help when we sent a fire brigade to extinguish that blaze.
I will always accept help saving lives, Grandmother said. But I need no help in locking them away. Thank you.
Is it because this Forch is twin-born? Are you frightened of his powers?
She gave him a scornful look.
Elder,
he said, taking a breath,
you have a criminal among you.
If we do, she said, we will deal with the individual ourselves. I have visited the houses of sorrow and destruction you outsiders call prisons, Captain. I will not see one of my own immured there, based on hearsay and anonymous fancies sent via post.
The constable breathed out and stood up straight again. He set something new down on the desk with a snap. Waxilium squinted to see, but the constable was covering the object with his hand.
Do you know much about arson, Elder?
The constable asked softly.
It's often what we call a companion crime. You find it used to cover a burglary, to perpetrate fraud, or as an act of initial aggression. In a case like this, the fire is commonly just a harbinger. At best, you have a firebug who is waiting to burn again. At worst, well, something bigger is coming, Elder. Something you'll all regret.
Grandmother drew her lips to a line. The constable removed his hand, revealing what he'd put on the desk. A bullet.
What is this?
Grandmother said.
A reminder.
Grandmother slapped it off the table, sending it snapping against the wall near where Waxilium hid. He jumped back and crouched lower, heart pounding.
Do not bring your instruments of death into this place, Grandmother hissed.
Waxilium got back to the window in time to see the constable settling his hat on his head.
When that boy burns something again, he said softly, send for me. Hopefully it won't be too late. Good evening.
He left without a further word. Maxilium huddled against the side of the building, worried the constable would look back and see him. It didn't happen. The man marched out along the path, disappearing into the evening shadows. But grandmother, she hadn't believed. Couldn't she see? Forch had committed a crime. They were just going to leave him alone? Why?
Asinthio, grandmother said, using Waxillium's terrace name as she always did. Would you please join me?
He felt an immediate spike of alarm, followed by shame. He stood up. How did you know? He said through the window.
Reflection on my mirror, child, she said, holding a cup of tea in both hands, not looking toward him. Obey, if you please.
Sullenly he trudged around the building and through the front doors of the wooden lodge. The whole place smelled of the wood stain he'd recently helped apply. He still had the stuff under his fingernails. He stepped into the room and shut the door.
Why did you— Please sit down, Cynthia, she said softly.
He walked to the desk, but didn't take the guest seat. He remained standing right where the constable had.
Your handwriting, grandmother said, brushing at the paper the constable had left. Did I not tell you that the matter of Forch was under control?
You say a lot of things, grandmother. I believe when I see proof.
Woffendahl leaned forward, steam rising from the cup in her hands.
Oh, Cynthia, she said, I thought you were determined to fit in here.
I am.
Then why are you listening at my window instead of doing evening meditations?
He looked away, blushing.
The terrace way is about order, child, grandmother said. We have rules for a reason.
And burning down buildings isn't against the rules?
Of course it is, grandmother said. But Forch is not your responsibility. We've spoken to him. He's penitent. His crime was that of a misguided youth who spends too much time alone. I've asked some of the others to befriend him. He will do penance for his crime in our way. Would you rather see him rot in prison?
Waxillium hesitated, then sighed, dropping into the chair before his grandmother's desk.
I want to find out what is right, he whispered, and do it. Why is that so hard?
Grandmother frowned.
It's easy to discover what is right and wrong, child. I will admit that always choosing to follow what you know you should do is—
No,
Waxillium said. Then he winced. It wasn't wise to interrupt Grandmother V. She never yelled, but her disapproval could be sensed as surely as an imminent thunderstorm. He continued more softly.
No, Grandmother. Finding out what's right isn't easy.
It is written in our ways. It is taught every day in your lessons.
That's one voice, Waxillium said. One philosophy. There are so many.
Grandmother reached across the desk and put her hand on his. Her skin was warm from holding the teacup.
Ah, Asinthio, she said. I understand how hard it must be for you, a child of two worlds.
Two worlds, he thought immediately, but no home.
But you must heed what you are taught, grandmother continued. You promised me you would obey our rules while you were here.
I've been trying.
I know. I hear good reports from Tellingdwar and your other instructors. They say you learn the material better than anyone, that it's as if you've lived here all your life. I'm proud of your effort.
The other kids don't accept me. I've tried to do as you say, to be more Terrace than anyone, to prove my blood to them.
But the kids... I'll never be one of them, Grandmother.
Never is a word youths often use, Grandmother said, sipping her tea, but rarely understand. Let the rules become your guide. In them you will find peace. If some are resentful because of your zeal, let them be. Eventually, through meditation, they will make peace with such emotions.
Could you maybe order a few of the others to befriend me?
He found himself asking, ashamed of how weak it sounded to say the words.
Like you did with Forge?
I will see, Grandmother said. Now off with you. I will not report this indiscretion, Asinthew, but please promise me you will set aside this obsession with Forge and leave the punishment of others to the Synod.
Waxelia moved to stand up, and his foot slipped on something. He reached down. The bullet.
Asinthew? Grandmother asked.
He trapped the bullet in his fist as he straightened, then hurried out the door.
Metal is your life,
Tellingdwar said from the front of the hut, moving into the final parts of the evening recitation. Waxillium knelt in meditation, listening to the words. Around him rose a peaceful terrace, were similarly bowed in reverence, offering praise to Preservation, the ancient god of their faith.
Metal is your soul,
Tellingdwar said. So much was perfect in this quiet world. Why did Waxillium sometimes feel like he was dragging dirt in solely by being here? That they were all part of one big white canvas and he was a smudge at the bottom.
You preserve us,
Tellingdwar said,
and so we will be yours.
A bullet, Waxillium thought, the bit of metal still clenched in his palm. Why did he leave a bullet as a reminder? What does it mean? It seemed an odd symbol. Recitation complete, the youths, children, and adults alike rose and stretched. There was some jovial interaction, but curfew had nearly arrived, which meant that the younger set had to be on their way to their homes, or in Waxillium's case, the dormitories. He remained kneeling anyway. Tellingdwar started gathering up the mats people had used for kneeling. He kept his head shaved. His robes were bright yellows and oranges. Arms laden with mats, he paused as he noticed Waxillium hadn't left with the others.
Asinthew?
Are you well?
Waxillium nodded tiredly, climbing to his feet, legs numb from kneeling so long. He plodded toward the exit, where he paused. Tellingdwar?
Yes, Asinthew.
Has there ever been a violent crime in the village? The short steward froze, his grip tightening on the load of mats.
What makes you ask?
Curiosity?
You needn't worry.
That was long ago.
What was long ago? Tellingdwar retrieved the remaining mats, moving more quickly than before. Perhaps someone else would have avoided the question, but Tellingdwar was as candid as they came. A classic terrace virtue. In his eyes, avoiding a question would be as bad as lying.
I'm not surprised they're still whispering about it,
Tellingdwar said.
15 years can't wash away that blood, I suppose. The rumors are wrong, however. Only one person was killed. A woman, by her husband's hand. Both terrorists.
He hesitated.
I knew them.
How did he kill her?
Must you know this?
Well, the rumors... Tellingdwar sighed.
A gun. An outsider weapon. We don't know where he got it.
Tellingdwar shook his head, dropping the mats into a stack at the side of the room.
I guess we shouldn't be surprised. Men are the same everywhere, Asinthew. You must remember this. Do not think yourself better than another because you wear the robe.
Trust Tellingdwar to turn any conversation into a lesson. Waxillium nodded to him and slipped out into the night. The sky rumbled above, foretelling rain, but there was no mist yet.
Men are the same everywhere, Asinthew.
What was the purpose, then, of everything they taught in here, if it couldn't prevent men from acting like monsters? He reached the boys' dorm, which was quiet. It was just after curfew, and Waxillium had to bow his head to the dorm master in apology before rushing down the hallway and into his room on the ground floor. Waxillium's father had insisted he be given a room to himself because of his noble heritage. That had only served to set him apart from the others. He shucked off his robe and threw open his wardrobe. His old clothing hung there. Rain began to patter against his window as he threw on some trousers and a buttoning shirt, which he found more comfortable than those rusting robes. He trimmed his lamp and sat back on his cot, opening a book for some evening reading. Outside, the sky rumbled like an empty stomach. Waxillium tried to read for a few minutes, then tossed the book aside, nearly knocking over his lamp, and threw himself to his feet. He walked to the window, watching the water stream down. It fell in patches and columns because of the thick canopy of leaves. He reached over and extinguished the lamp. He stared at the rain, thoughts tumbling in his head. He'd have to make a decision soon. The agreement between his grandmother and his parents required Waxillium to spend 1 year in the village, and only a month of that remained. After that, it would be his choice whether to stay or to leave. What awaited him outside? White tablecloths, posturing people with nasal accents and politics. What awaited him here? Quiet rooms, meditation, and boredom. A life he detested, or a life of mind-numbing repetition? Day after day after day, and... Was that someone moving through the trees? Waxillium perked up, pressing against the cool glass. That was someone trudging through the wet forest, a shadowed figure with a familiar height and posture, stooped and carrying a sack over his shoulder. Forge glanced toward the dormitory, but then continued on into the night. So they were back. That was faster than he'd expected. What was Telson's plan for getting into the dorms? Slip in through the windows, then claim they'd come home before curfew and the dorm master just hadn't seen them? Waxillium waited, wondering if he'd spot the three girls as well, but saw nothing, only Forge, disappearing into the shadows. Where was he going? Another fire, Waxillium thought immediately. But Forge wouldn't do it in this rain, would he? Waxillium glanced at the clock ticking quietly on his wall. An hour after curfew. He hadn't realized he'd spent so much time staring at the rain. Forge is not my problem, he told himself firmly. He walked back to lie on his bed, but soon found himself pacing instead, listening to the rain, anxious, unable to stop his body from moving. Curfew.
Let the rules become your guide. In them find peace.
He stopped beside the window. Then he pushed it open and leaped out, bare feet sinking into the wet, rubbery ground. He scrambled forward, streams of water spraying across his head, trickling down the back of his shirt. Which way had Forge gone? He took his best guess, passing enormous trees like hewn monoliths, the rush of rain and streaming water drowning out all else. A boot print in the mud near a tree trunk hinted he was on the right track, but he had to lean down low to see it. Rusts! It was getting dark out here. Where next? Waxillium turned about. There, he thought. Storage hall. An old dormitory, now unoccupied, where the terrace kept extra furniture and rugs. That would be a perfect target for arson, right? Plenty of stuff inside to burn, and nobody would expect it in this rain.
But Grandmother spoke to him, Waxillium thought, scrambling through the rain, feet cold as he kicked up fallen leaves and moss. They'll know it was him.
Didn't he care? Was he trying to get into trouble? Waxillium stepped up to the old dormitory, a three-story mass of blackness in the already dark night, showers of water streaming off its eaves. Waxillium tested the door, and it was unlocked, of course. This was the village. He slipped inside. There, a pool of water on the floor. Someone had entered here recently. He followed in a crouch, touching the footprints one after another until he reached the stairwell. Up one flight, then another. What was up here? He reached the top floor and saw a light ahead. Waxillium crept through a hallway with a rug down the center, approaching what turned out to be a flickering candle set on a table in a small room, cluttered with furniture and with dark, heavy drapes on the walls. Waxillium stepped up to the candle. It shivered, frail and alone. Why had Forch left it here? What was... Something heavy smashed across Waxillium's back. He gasped in pain, thrown forward by the blow, stumbling into a pair of chairs stacked atop one another. Boots thumped on the floor behind him. Waxillium managed to throw himself to the side, rolling to the floor as Forch smashed an old wooden post into the chairs, cracking them. Waxillium scrambled to his feet, his shoulders throbbing. Forch turned toward him, face all in shadow. Waxillium backed away.
"Forch, it's all right. I just want to talk."
He winced as his back hit the wall.
"You don't have to..."
Forch came at him swinging. Waxillium yelped and ducked into the hallway.
"Help!"
he shouted as Forch followed him.
"Help!"
Waxillium had meant to scramble toward the stairs, but he'd gotten turned around. Instead, he was running away from them. He slammed his shoulder against the door at the end of the hallway. That would lead to the upper meeting room, if the dormitory here had the same layout as his own. And maybe another set of steps? Waxillium pushed through the door and into a brighter room. Old tables stacked atop one another surrounded an open space at the center, like an audience and a stage. There, in the middle, and lit by a dozen candles, a young boy of maybe 5 lay tied to a wooden plank that stretched between 2 tables. His shirt had been cut off and lay on the floor. His cries were muffled by a gag, and he struggled weakly against his bonds. Waxillium stumbled to a halt, taking in the boy, the line of gleaming knives set out on a table nearby, the trails of blood from cuts in the boy's chest.
"Oh, hell,"
Waxillium whispered. Forch entered behind him, then closed the door with a click.
"Oh, hell,"
Waxillium said, turning wide-eyed.
"Forch, what is wrong with you?"
"Don't know," the young man said softly. "I've just got to see what's inside, you know?"
"You went with the girls," Waxillium said, "so you'd have an alibi. If your room is found empty, you'll say you were with them. A lesser infraction to hide your true crime. Rusts. My sister and the others don't know that you've slipped back, do they? They're out there drunk, and they won't even remember that you were gone. They'll swear you were..."
Waxillium cut off as Forch looked up, eyes reflecting candlelight, face expressionless. He held up a handful of nails.
"That's right. Forch is a..."
Waxillium shouted, throwing himself toward a pile of furniture as nails zipped from Forch's hand, pushed by his allomancy. They hit like hail, snapping against wooden tables, chair legs, and the floor. A sudden pain struck Wax in the arm as he scuttled backward. He cried out, grabbing his arm as he got behind cover. One of the nails had ripped off a chunk of flesh near the elbow.
Metal. He needed metal.
It had been months since he'd burned steel. Grandmother wanted him to embrace his terrace side. He raised his arms and found them bare. His bracers...
"In your room, idiot,"
Waxillium thought. He fished in his trouser pocket. He always used to keep...
"A pouch of metal flakes."
He dug it out as he scrambled away from Forch, who threw aside tables and chairs to get to him. In the background, the captive child whimpered. Waxillium's fingers trembled as he tried to get the packet of metal flakes open, but it suddenly leaped from his fingers and shot across the room. He spun on Forch, desperate, just in time to see the man slide a metal bar off a table and toss it. Waxillium tried to duck, too slow. The steel-pushed bar slammed against his chest, throwing him backward. Forch grunted, stumbling. He wasn't practiced with his allomancy and hadn't properly braced himself. His push threw him backward as much as it tossed Waxillium. Still, Waxillium hit the wall with a grunt and he felt something crack inside of him. He gasped, his vision blackening as he dropped to his knees. The room wavered.
"The pouch. Get the pouch."
He searched the floor around him, frantic, barely able to think. He needed that metal. His fingers, bloodied, brushed it. Eager, he snatched the pouch and pulled open the cloth top. He tipped back his head to dump the flakes in. A shadow thundered over to him and kicked him in the stomach. The broken bone inside of Waxillium gave, and he screamed, having gotten barely a pinch of metal into his mouth. Forch slapped the pouch out of his hand, scattering the flakes, then picked him up. The youth looked bulkier than he should have, tapping a metal mind. A frenzied part of Waxillium's brain tried to push on the man's bracers, but ferrochemical metal minds were infamously difficult to affect with allomancy. His push wasn't strong enough. Forch shoved Waxillium out the open window, dangling him by his neck. Rain washed over Waxillium, and he struggled for breath.
"Please, Forch!"
Forch dropped him. Waxillium fell with the rain. 3 stories down, through the branches of a maple tree scattering wet leaves. Steel burned to life inside of him, spraying blue lines from his chest to nearby sources of metal. All above, none below. Nothing to push on to save himself. Except one bit in his trouser pocket. Waxillium pushed on it, desperate, as he tumbled in the air. It shot through his pocket, down along his leg, cutting a line in the side of his foot before being propelled down into the ground by his weight. Waxillium jerked in the air, slowing as soon as the bit of metal hit the ground. He crashed onto the sodden pathway feet first, pain jolting up his legs. He fell back to the ground and found himself dazed, but alive. His push had saved him. Rain fell on his face. He waited, but Forch didn't come down to finish him off. The youth had slammed the shutters, perhaps worried someone would see the light of his candles. Every part of Waxillium ached. Shoulders from the first blow, legs from the fall, chest from the bar. How many ribs had he broken? He lay there in the rain, coughing, before finally rolling over to find the bit of metal that had saved his life. He found it easily by following its allomantic line, and dug in the mud, pulling out something and holding it up. The constable's bullet. Rain washed his hand, cleansing the metal. He didn't even remember stuffing it into his pocket.
"In a case like this, the fire is often just a harbinger."
He should go get help. But that boy above was already bleeding. The knives were out.
"Something bigger is coming, Elder. Something you'll all regret."
Suddenly Waxillium hated Forch. This place was perfect, serene, beautiful. Darkness shouldn't exist here. If Waxillium was a smudge on the white canvas, this man was a pit of pure blackness. Waxillium shouted, climbing to his feet and throwing himself through the back door and into the old building. He climbed 2 flights in a haze of stumbling pain before slamming open the door into the meeting room. Forch stood above the weeping child, a bloody knife in his hand. He turned his head slowly, showing Waxillium 1 eye, half of his face. Waxillium threw the single bullet up between them, its casing glittering in candlelight, then pushed with everything he had. Forch turned and pushed back. The reaction was immediate. The bullet stopped in midair, inches from Forch's face. Both men were thrown backward, but Forch caught himself on a group of tables, staying steady. Waxillium was slammed against the wall beside the doorway. Forch smiled, and his muscles swelled, strength drawn from his metal mind. He pulled his bar from the table of knives and threw it at Waxillium, who cried out, pushing against it to stop it from smashing him. He wasn't strong enough. Forch continued to push, and Waxillium had so little steel. The bar slipped forward in the air, pressing against Waxillium's chest, pushing him against the wall. Time froze. 1 bullet hanging just before Forch, their main fight over the bar which, bit by bit, crushed Waxillium. His chest flared in pain, and a scream slipped from his lips. He was going to die here.
"I just want to do what is right. Why is that so hard?"
Forch stepped forward, grinning. Waxillium's eyes fixed on that bullet, glittering golden. He couldn't breathe. But that bullet...
"Metal is your life."
A bullet. 3 parts metal. The tip.
"Metal is your soul."
The casing.
"You preserve us."
And the knob at the back. The spot the hammer would hit. In that moment, to Waxillium's eyes, they split into 3 lines, 3 parts. He took them all in at once. And then, as the bar crushed him, he let go of 2 bits. And shoved on that knob at the back. The bullet exploded, The casing flipped backward into the air, pushed by Forge's allomancy, but the bullet itself zipped forward, untouched, before drilling into Forge's skull. Vexillium dropped to the ground. The bar propelled away. He collapsed in a heap, gasping for breath, rainwater streaming from his face to the wooden floor. In a daze, he heard voices below. People finally responding to the shouts, then the sound of gunfire. He forced himself to his feet and limped through the room, ignoring the voices of terrace men and women who climbed the steps. He reached the child and ripped off the bonds, freeing him. Instead of running in fear, however, the little boy grabbed Wax's leg and held on tight, weeping. People poured into the room. Vexillium leaned down, picking up the bullet casing off the wet floor, then stood up straight and faced them. Telingdwar, his grandmother, the elders. He registered their horror, and knew in that moment they would hate him because he had brought violence into their village. Hate him because he had been right. He stood beside Forge's corpse and closed one hand around the bullet casing, resting his other on the head of the trembling child.
"I will find my own way," he whispered.
28 years later. The hideout door slammed against the other wall, shedding a burst of dust. A wall of mist fell in around the man who had kicked it open, outlining his silhouette. A mist coat, tassels flaring from motion, a combat shotgun held up to the side.
"Fire!"
Miggs cried. The lads unloaded. 8 men, armed to the teeth, fired at the shadowy figure from behind their barricade inside the old pub. Bullets swarmed like insects, but parted around this man in the long coat. They pelted the wall, drilling holes in the door and splintering the doorframe. They cut trails through the encroaching mist, but the lawman, all black in the gloom, didn't so much as flinch. Miggs fired shot after shot, despairing. He emptied one pistol, then a second, then shouldered his rifle and fired as quickly as he could cock it. How had they gotten here? Rusts, how had this happened? It wasn't supposed to have gone like this.
"It's useless," one of the lads cried. "He's gonna kill us all, Miggs." "Why are you just standing there?" Meg shouted at the lawman. "Be at it already."
He fired twice more.
"What's wrong with you?"
"Maybe he's distracting us," one of the lads said, "so his pal can sneak up behind us."
"Hey, that's—"
Miggs hesitated, looking toward the one who had spoken. Round face, simple round coachman's hat, like a bowler, but flatter on top. "Who was that man again?" He counted his crew.
9?
The lad next to Miggs smiled, tipped his hat, then decked him in the face. It was over blurringly quick. The fellow in the coachman's cap laid out Slink and Gillian in an eye blink. Then suddenly he was closer to the two on the far side, slapping them down with a pair of dueling canes. As Miggs turned, fumbling for the gun he'd dropped, the lawman leaped over the barricade with tassels flying and kicked drawers in the chin. The lawman spun, leveling his shotgun at the men on the other side. They dropped their guns. Miggs knelt, sweating, beside an overturned table. He waited for the gunshots. They didn't come.
"Ready for you, Captain?"
the lawman shouted. A pile of constables rushed through the doorway, disturbing the mists. Outside, morning light was starting to dispel those anyway. Rusts. Had they really holed up in here all night? The lawman swung his gun down toward Miggs.
"You might want to drop that gun, friend," he said in a conversational tone.
Miggs hesitated.
"Just shoot me, lawman. I'm in too deep."
"You shot 2 constables, the man said, finger on the trigger.
"But they'll live, son. You won't hang if I have my way. Drop the gun."
They'd called those same words before from outside. This time, Miggs found himself believing them.
"Why?"
he asked.
"You could have killed us all without breaking a sweat."
"Why?"
"Because," the lawman said, "frankly, you're not worth killing."
He smiled in a friendly type way.
"I've got enough on my conscience already. Drop the gun. We'll get this sorted out."
Miggs dropped the gun and stood, then waved down Drawers, who was climbing up with his gun in hand. The man reluctantly dropped his weapon, too. The lawman turned, cresting the barricade with an alimentic leap, and slammed his shortened shotgun into a holster on his leg. The younger man in the coachman's hat joined him, whistling softly. He appeared to have swiped Gillian's favorite knife. The ivory hilt was sticking out of his pocket.
"They're yours, Captain," the lawman said. "Not staying for the booking, Wax?" the constable captain asked, turning. "Unfortunately, no," the lawman said. "I have to get to a wedding."
"Whose?"
"Mine, I'm afraid."
"You came on a raid the morning of your wedding?"
the captain asked. The lawman, Waxillium Ladrian, stopped in the doorway.
"In my defense, it wasn't my idea."
He nodded one more time to the assembled constables and gang members, then strode out into the mists. Part 1. 1. Waxillium Ladrian hurried down the steps outside the bar-turned-hideout, passing constables in brown who bustled this way and that. The mists were already evaporating, dawn heralding the end of their vigil. He checked his arm, where a bullet had ripped a sizable hole through the cuff of his shirt and out the side of his jacket. He'd felt that one pass.
"Oi!" Wayne said, hustling up beside him. "A good plan that one was, eh?"
"It was the same plan you always have," Wax said. "The one where I get to be the decoy."
"Ain't my fault people like to shoot at you, mate," Wayne said as they reached the coach. "You should be happy. You're using your talents, like me granner's always said a man should do."
"I'd rather not have shootability be my talent."
"Well, you gotta use what you have,"
Wayne said, leaning against the side of the carriage as Cobb, the coachman, opened the door for Wax.
"Same reason I always have bits of rat in my stew."
Wax looked into the carriage, with its fine cushions and rich upholstery, but didn't climb in.
"You gonna be all right?" Wayne asked.
"Of course I am," Wax said. "This is my second marriage. I'm an old hand at the practice by now."
Wayne grinned.
"Oh, is that how it works? 'Cause in my experience, marrying is the one thing people seem to get worse at the more they do it. Well, that and being alive."
Wayne, that was almost profound.
"Damn, I was aiming for insightful."
Wax stood still, looking into the carriage. The coachman cleared his throat, still standing and holding the door open for him.
"Right pretty news, that is," Wayne noted.
"Don't be melodramatic," Wax said, leaning to climb in.
"Lord Ladrian,"
a voice called from behind. Wax glanced over his shoulder, noting a tall man in a dark brown suit and bow tie pushing between a pair of constables.
"Lord Ladrian,"
the man said.
"Could I have a moment, please?"
"Take them all," Wax said, "but do it without me."
"But—"
"I'll meet you there," Wax said, nodding to Wayne.
He dropped a spent bullet shell, then pushed himself into the air. Why waste time on a carriage? Steel had a comfortable burn inside his stomach. He shoved in a nearby electric streetlight, still shining, though morning had arrived, and soared higher into the air. Ellendale spread before him, a soot-stained marvel of a city, leaking smoke from 100,000 different homes and factories. Wax shoved off the steel frame of a half-finished building nearby, then sent himself in a series of leaping bounds across the fourth octant. He passed over a field of carriages for hire, rows of vehicles waiting quietly in ranks, early morning workers looking up at him as he passed. One pointed. Perhaps the mist coat had drawn his attention. Coin-shot couriers weren't an uncommon sight in Ellendale, and men soaring through the air were rarely a point of interest. A few more leaps took him over a series of warehouses in huddled rows. Wax thrilled in each jump. It was amazing how this could still feel so wonderful to him. The breeze in his face, the little moment of weightlessness when he hung at the very top of an arc. All too soon, however, both gravity and duty reasserted themselves. He left the industrial district and crossed finer roadways, paved with pitch and gravel to create a smoother surface than cobbles for all those blasted motor cars. He spotted the survivorist church easily, with its large glass and steel dome. Back in Wuthering, a simple wooden chapel had been sufficient. But that wasn't nearly grand enough for Ellendale. The design was to allow those who worshipped full view of the mists at night. Wax figured if they wanted to see the mists, they'd do better just stepping outside. But perhaps he was being cynical. After all, the dome, which was made of segments of glass between steel supports, making it look like the sections of an orange, was able to open inward and let the mist pour down for special occasions. He landed on a rooftop water tower across from the church. Perhaps when it had been built, the church's dome had been tall enough to overshadow the surrounding buildings. It would have provided a nice profile. Now buildings were rising taller and taller, and the church was dwarfed by its surroundings. Wayne would find a metaphor in that, probably a crude one. He perched on the water tower, looming over the church. So he was here, finally. He felt his eye begin to twitch, and an ache rose within him.
"I think I loved you even on that day. So ridiculous, but so earnest."
6 months ago, he'd pulled the trigger. He could still hear the gunshot. Standing up, he pulled himself together. He'd healed this wound once. He could do so again. And if that left his heart crusted with scar tissue, then perhaps that was what he needed. He leaped off the water tower, then slowed by dropping and pushing on a shell casing. He hit the street and strode past a long line of carriages. Guests were already in attendance. Survivorist tenants called for weddings either very early in the morning or late at night. Wax nodded to several people he passed, and couldn't help slipping his shotgun out of its holster and resting it on his shoulder as he hopped up the steps and shoved the door open before him with a steel push. Steris paced in the foyer, wearing a sleek white dress that had been chosen because the magazines said it was fashionable. With her hair braided and her makeup done by a professional for the occasion, she was actually quite pretty. He smiled when he saw her. His stress, his nervousness, melted away a little. Steris looked up as soon as he entered, then hurried to his side.
"And?"
"I didn't get killed," he said, "so there's that." She glanced at the clock.
"You're late," she said, "but not very late."
"I'm sorry?" She'd insisted he go on the raid. She'd planned for it, in fact. Such was life with Steris.
"I'm sure you did your best," Steris said, taking his arm.
She was warm and even trembling. Steris might be reserved, but unlike what some assumed, she wasn't emotionless.
"The raid?" she asked.
"Went well. No casualties." He walked with her to a side chamber where Druten, his valet, waited beside a table spread with Wax's white wedding suit. "You realize that by going on a raid on the morning of my wedding, I'll only reinforce this image that society has of me."
"Which image?"
"That of a ruffian," he said, taking off his mist coat and handing it to Druten. "A barely civilized lout from the roughs who curses in church and goes to parties armed." She glanced at his shotgun, which he'd tossed onto the sofa.
"You enjoy playing with people's perceptions of you, don't you? You seek to make them uncomfortable so they'll be off balance."
"It's one of the simple joys I have left, Steris." He smiled as Druten unbuttoned his waistcoat. Then he pulled off both that and his shirt, leaving him bare-chested.
"I see. I'm included in those you try to make uncomfortable," Steris said.
"I work with what I have," Wax said.
"Which is why you always have bits of rat in your stew?"
Wax hesitated in handing his clothing to Druten. "He said that to you, too?"
"Yes. I'm increasingly convinced he tries the lines out on me." She folded her arms. "The little mongrel."
"Not going to leave as I change?" Wax asked, amused.
"We're to be married in less than an hour, Lord Waxillium," she said. I think I can stand to see you bare-chested. As a side note, you're the Pathian. Prudishness is part of your belief system, not mine. I've read of Kelsier. From what I've studied, I doubt he'd care if—
Wax undid the wooden buttons on his trousers. Steris blushed before turning around and finally putting her back to him. She continued speaking a moment later, sounding flustered.
Well, at least you agreed to a proper ceremony.
Wax smiled, settling down in his undershorts and letting Druten give his face a quick shave. Steris remained in place, listening. Finally, as Druten was wiping the cream from Wax's face, she asked,
"You have the pendants?"
"Gave them to Wayne."
"You... what?"
"I thought you wanted some disturbances at the wedding," Wax said, standing and taking the new set of trousers from Druten.
He slipped them on. He hadn't worn white much since returning from the roughs. It was harder to keep clean out there, which had made it worth wearing.
"I figured this would work."
"I wanted planned disturbances, Lord Waxillium," Steris snapped. "It's not upsetting if it's understood, prepared for, and controlled. Wayne is rather the opposite of those things, wouldn't you say?"
Wax did up his buttons, and Druten took his shirt off the hanger nearby. Steris turned around immediately upon hearing the sound, arms still folded, and didn't miss a beat, refusing to acknowledge that she'd been embarrassed.
"I'm glad I had copies made."
"You made copies of our wedding pendants?"
"Yes."
She chewed her lip a moment.
"Six sets."
"Six?"
"The other four didn't arrive in time."
Wax grinned, doing up the buttons on his shirt, then letting his valet handle the cuffs.
"You're one of a kind, Steris."
"Technically, so is Wayne. And actually, so is Ruin, for that matter. If you consider it, that's not much of a compliment."
Wax strapped on his suspenders, then let Druten fuss over his collar.
"I don't get it, Steris," he said,
standing stiffly as the valet worked.
"You prepare so thoroughly for things to go wrong. Like you know and expect that life is unpredictable."
"Yes, and?"
"And life is unpredictable. So the only thing you do by preparing for disturbances is ensure that something else is going to go wrong."
"That's a rather fatalistic viewpoint."
"Living in the roughs does that to a fellow."
He eyed her, standing resplendent in her dress, arms crossed, tapping her left arm with her right index finger.
"I just feel better when I try,"
Steris finally said.
"It's like, if everything goes wrong, at least I tried. Does that make sense?"
"As a matter of fact, I think it does."
Druten stepped back, satisfied. The suit came with a very nice black cravat and vest. Traditional, which Wax preferred. Bow ties were for salesmen. He slid on the jacket, tails brushing the backs of his legs. Then, after a moment's hesitation, he strapped on his gun belt and slid Vindication into her holster. He'd worn a gun to his last wedding, so why not this one? Steris nodded in approval. Shoes went last. A new pair. They'd be hideously uncomfortable.
"Are we late enough yet?"
he asked Steris. She checked the clock in the corner.
"I planned for us to go in 2 minutes from now."
"Ah, delightful," he said, taking her arm. "That means we can be spontaneous and arrive early. Well, late early."
She clung to his arm, letting him steer her down the side chamber toward the entrance to the dome and the church proper. Druten followed behind.
"Are you certain you wish to proceed?"
Steris asked, stopping him before they entered the walkway to the dome.
"Having second thoughts?"
"Absolutely not," Steris said immediately. "This union is quite beneficial to my house and status."
She took Wax's left hand in both of hers.
"But, Lord Waxillium," she said softly, "I don't want you to feel trapped, particularly after what happened to you earlier this year. If you wish to back out, I will accept it as your will."
The way she clutched his hand as she said those words sent a very different message, but she didn't seem to notice. Looking at her, Wax found himself wondering. When he'd first agreed to the marriage, he'd done so out of duty to his house. Now he felt his emotions shifting. The way she'd been there for him these last months as he'd grieved. The way she looked at him right now. Rust and ruin. He was actually fond of Steris. It wasn't love, but he doubted he would love again. This would do. "No, Steris," he said. "I would not back out. That wouldn't be fair to your house and the money you have spent."
"The money doesn't..."
"It's all right," Wax said, giving her hand a little squeeze. "I have recovered enough from my ordeal. I'm strong enough to do this." Steris opened her mouth to reply, but a knock at the door heralded Marisie sticking her head in to check on them. With dark hair and softer, rounder features than Steris, Marisie wore bright red lipstick and a progressive lady's attire. A pleated skirt with a tight-buttoned jacket.
"Finally," she said. "Crowd is getting fidgety. Wax, there's a man here wanting to see you. I've been trying to send him away, but..." "Well?"
She came into the room and held the door open, revealing the same slender man in the brown suit and bow tie from before, standing with the Ash girls in the antechamber that led to the dome proper.
"You," Wax said. "How did you get here before Wayne?"
"I don't believe your friend is coming," the man said.
He stepped in beside Marisie and nodded to her, then closed the doors, shutting out the Ash girls. He turned and tossed Wax a wadded-up ball of paper. When Wax caught it, it clinked. Unfolding it revealed the two wedding pendants. Scrawled on the paper were the words, "Gonna go get smashed till I can't piss straight. Happy weddings and stuff."
"Such beautiful imagery,"
Steris observed, taking Wax's wedding pendant in a white-gloved hand as Marisie looked over his shoulder to read the note.
"At least he didn't forget these."
"Thank you," Wax said to the man in brown. "But as you can see, I'm quite busy getting married. Whatever you need from me can..."
The man's face turned translucent, displaying the bones of his skull and spine beneath. Steris stiffened.
"Holy one," she whispered.
"Holy pain," Wax said. "Tell Harmony to get someone else this time. I'm busy."
"Tell Harmony?"
Steris mumbled, her eyes wide.
"Unfortunately, this is part of the problem," the man in brown said, his skin returning to normal. "Harmony has been distracted as of late." "How can God be distracted?" Marisie asked. "We are not sure, but it has us worried. I need you, Waxillium Ladrian. I have a job you'll find of interest. I realize you're off to the ceremony, but afterward, if I could have a moment of your time..."
"No," Wax said.
"But..."
"No!"
Wax pulled Steris by the arm, shoving open the doors, striding past Marisie, leaving the Chondra. It had been 6 months since those creatures had manipulated him, played him, and lied to him. The result? A dead woman in his arms. Bastards.
"Was that really one of the faceless immortals?" Steris said,
looking over her shoulder.
"Yes, and for obvious reasons I want nothing to do with him."
"Peace,"
she said, holding his arm.
"Do you need a moment?"
"No."
"You're sure?"
Wax stopped in place. She waited, and he breathed in and out, banishing from his mind that awful, awful scene when he'd knelt on a bridge alone holding Lessie, a woman he realized he'd never actually known.
"I'm all right," he said to Steris through clenched teeth. "But God should have known not to come for me, particularly not today."
"Your life is decidedly odd, Lord Waxillium."
"I know," he said,
moving again, stepping with her beside the last door before they entered the dome.
"Ready?"
"Yes. Thank you."
Was she teary-eyed? It was an expression of emotion he'd never seen from her.
"Are you all right?" he asked.
"Yes,"
she said.
"Forgive me. It's just..." more wonderful than I'd imagined.
They pushed open the doors, revealing the glistening dome, sunlight streaming through it and upon the waiting crowd. Acquaintances, distant family members, seamstresses and forge workers from his house. Wax sought out Wayne and was surprised when he didn't find the man, despite the note. He was the only real family Wax had. The ash girls scampered out, sprinkling small handfuls of ash on the carpeted walkway that ringed the perimeter of the dome. Wax and Steris started forward in a stately walk, presenting themselves for those in attendance. There was no music at a survivorist ceremony, but a few crackling braziers with green leaves on top let smoke trail upward to represent the mist. Smoke ascends while ash falls, he thought, remembering the priest's words from his youth back when he'd attended survivorist ceremonies. They walked all the way around the crowd. At last, Steris's family had made a decent showing, her father included. The red-faced man gave Waxillium an enthusiastic fist raise as they passed. Wax found himself smiling. This was what Lessie had wanted. They'd joked time and time again about their simple Pathian ceremony, finalized on horseback to escape a mob. She said that someday she'd make him do it proper. Sparkling crystal, a hushed crowd, footsteps on scrunching carpet dappled with gray ash. His smile widened, and he looked to the side. But of course, the wrong woman was there. He almost stumbled. Idiot man, he thought. Focus. This day was important to Steris. The least he could do was not ruin it. Or rather, not ruin it in a way she hadn't expected. Whatever that meant. Unfortunately, as they walked the remaining distance around the rotunda, his discomfort increased. He felt nauseous, sweaty, sick, like the feeling he had gotten the few times he had been forced to run from a killer and leave innocence in danger. It all forced him, finally, to acknowledge a difficult fact. He wasn't ready. It wasn't Steris, it wasn't the setting. He just wasn't ready for this. This marriage meant letting go of Lessie. But he was trapped, and he had to be strong. He set his jaw and stepped with Steris onto the dais, where the priest stood between two stands topped with crystal vases of Merwill flowers. The ceremony was drawn from ancient Larsta beliefs, from Harmony's Beliefs Reborn, a volume in the Words of Founding. The priest spoke the words, but Wax couldn't listen. All was numbness to him, teeth clenched, eyes straight ahead, muscles tense. They'd found a priest murdered in this very church, killed by Lessie as she went mad. Couldn't they have done something for her, instead of setting him on the hunt? Couldn't they have told him? Strength. He would not flee. He would not be a coward. He held Steris's hands, but couldn't look at her. Instead, he turned his face upward to look out the glass dome toward the sky. Most of it was crowded out by the buildings. Skyscrapers on two sides, windows glistening in the morning sun. That water tower certainly did block the view, though as he watched, it shifted. Shifted? Wax watched in horror as the legs under the enormous metal cylinder bent, as if to kneel, ponderously tipping their burden on its side. The top of the thing sheared off, spilling tons of water in a foaming wave. He yanked Steris to him, arm firmly around her waist, then ripped off the second button down on his waistcoat and dropped it. He pushed against this single metal button, launching himself and Steris away from the dais as the priest yelped in surprise. Water crashed against the dome, which strained for the briefest of seconds before a section of it snapped open, hinges giving way inward to the water. 2. Are you certain you're all right, my lord? Wax asked, helping Lord Drapin, Constable General of the 6th Octant, down the steps toward his carriage. Water trickled beside them in little streams, joining a small river in the gutters.
Ruined my best pistol, you realize, Drapin said. I'll have to send the thing to be cleaned and oiled.
Bill me the expense, my lord, Wax said, ignoring the fact that a good pistol would hardly be ruined by a little, or, well, a lot of water. Wax turned the aging gentleman over to his coachman, sharing a resigned look, before turning and climbing back up the steps into the church. The carpet squished when he stepped on it, or maybe that was his shoes. He passed the priest, bickering with the Arakel insurance assessor, come to do an initial report for when the church demanded payment on their policy, and entered the main dome. The one open section of glass still swung on its hinges up above, and the tipped water tower, its legs on the other side had kept it from crashing down completely, still blocked out much of the sky. He passed overturned benches, discarded marewill petals, and general refuse. Water dripped, the room's only sound other than the echoing voice of the priest. Wax squished his way up to the dais. Steris sat on its edge, wet dress plastered to her body, strands of hair that had escaped from her wedding braids sticking to the sides of her face. She sat with arms crossed on her knees, staring at the floor. Wax sat down next to her. So, next time a flood is dumped on our heads, I'll try to remember that jumping upward is a bad idea. He pulled his handkerchief from his pocket and squeezed it out.
You tried to get us backward, too. It merely wasn't fast enough, Lord Waxillium.
He grunted. Looks like simple structural failure. If it was instead some kind of assassination attempt, well, it was an incompetent one. There wasn't enough water in there to be truly dangerous. The worst injury was to Lord Stemming, who fell and knocked his head when scrambling off his seat.
No more than an accident, then, Steris said.
She flopped backward onto the dais, the carpet letting out a soft squish. I'm sorry.
It's not your fault, she sighed. Do you ever wonder if perhaps the Cosmere is out to overwhelm you, Lord Waxillium?
The Cosmere? You mean Harmony?
No, not him, Steris said. Just cosmic chance rolling the dice any time I pass and always hitting all ones. There seems to be a poetry to it all.
She closed her eyes.
Of course the wedding would fall apart. Several tons of water falling through the roof? Why wouldn't I have seen that? It was so utterly outlandish, it had to happen. At least the priest didn't get murdered this time.
Steris, Wax said, resting a hand on her arm. We'll fix this. It will be all right. She opened her eyes, looking toward him.
Thank you, Lord Waxillium.
For what, exactly? He asked.
For being nice. For being willing to subject yourself to, well, me. I understand that it is not a pleasant concept.
Steris?
Do not think me self-deprecating, Lord Waxillium,
she said, sitting up and taking a deep breath.
And please do not assume I'm being morose. I am what I am, and I accept it. But I am under no illusions as to how my company is regarded. Thank you for not making me feel as others have.
He hesitated. How did one respond to something like that? It's not as you say, Steris. I think you're delightful.
And the fact that you were gritting your teeth as the ceremony started, hands gripping as tightly as a man dangling for his life from the side of a bridge? Are you saddened at the fact that our wedding is delayed? Can you truly say it? And be honest as a lawman, Lord Waxillium.
Damn. He floundered. He knew a few simple words could diffuse or sidestep the question, but he couldn't find them, despite searching for what was an awkwardly long time, until saying anything would have sounded condescending. Perhaps, he said, smiling, I'll just have to try something to relax me next time we attempt this.
I doubt going to the ceremony drunk would be productive.
I didn't say I'd drink. Perhaps some terrace meditation beforehand. She eyed him.
You're still willing to move forward?
Of course. As long as it didn't have to be today. I assume you have a backup dress?
Two,
she admitted, letting him help her to her feet.
And I did reserve another date for a wedding 2 months from now. different church, in case this one exploded.
He grunted. You sound like Wayne.
Well, things do tend to explode around you, Lord Waxillium.
She looked up at the dome.
Considering that, getting drenched must be rather novel.
Marcy trailed around the outside of the flooded church, hands clasped behind her back, notebook a familiar weight in her jacket pocket. A few constables, all corporals, stood about looking as if they were in charge. That sort of thing was important in a crisis. Statistics showed that if a uniformed authority figure was nearby, people were less likely to panic. Of course, there was a smaller percentage who were more likely to panic if an authority figure was nearby. Because people were people, and if there was one thing you could count on, it was that some of them would be weird. Or rather, that all of them would be weird when circumstances happened to align with their own individual brand of insanity. That said, today she hunted a very special kind of insane. She'd tried the nearby pubs first, but that was too obvious. Next, she checked the gutters, one soup kitchen, and, against her better judgment, a purveyor of novelties. No luck, though her backside did get 3 separate compliments, so there was that. Finally, running out of ideas, she went to check if he'd decided to steal the forks from the wedding breakfast. There, in a dining hall across the street from the church, she found Wayne in the kitchens wearing a white jacket and a chef's hat. He was scolding several assistant cooks as they furiously decorated tarts with fruit glaze. Marcy leaned against the doorway and watched, tapping her notebook with her pencil. Wayne sounded utterly unlike himself, instead using a sharp nasal voice with an accent she couldn't quite place. Easterner, perhaps? Some of the outer cities there had thick accents. The assistant cooks didn't question him. They jumped at what he said, bearing his condemnation as he tasted a chilled soup and swore at their incompetence. If he noticed Marcy, he didn't show it, instead wiping his hands on a cloth and demanding to see the produce the delivery boys had brought that morning. Eventually, Marcy strolled into the kitchen, dodging a short assistant chef bearing a pot almost as big as she was, and stepped up to Wayne.
"I've seen crisper lettuce in the garbage heap,"
he was saying to a cringing delivery boy.
"And you call these grapes? They are so overripe, they're practically fermenting. And, oh, hello, Marcy."
He said the last line in his normal, jovial voice. The delivery boy scrambled away.
"What are you doing?" Marcy asked.
"Making soup," Wayne said, holding up a wooden spoon to show her. Nearby, several of the assistant cooks stopped in place, looking at him with shocked expressions.
"Out with you,"
he said to them in the chef's voice.
"I must have time to prepare. Shoo, shoo, go."
They scampered away, leaving him grinning.
"You do realize the wedding breakfast is canceled," Marcy said, leaning back against a table.
"Sure do."
"So why?"
She trailed off as he stuffed an entire tart in his mouth and grinned.
"I'll make sure they didn't welch on their promise and not make anything to eat,"
he said around chewing, crumbs cascading from his lips.
"We paid for this stuff. Well, Wax did. Besides, wedding being cancelled is no reason not to celebrate, right?"
"Depends on what you're celebrating," Marcy said, flipping open her notebook. "Bolts securing the water tower in place were definitely loosened. Road below was conspicuously empty. Some ruffians, from another octant entirely, I might add, having stopped traffic by starting a fistfight in the middle of the rusting street."
Wayne grunted, searching in a cupboard.
"Hate that little notebook of yours sometimes,"
Marcy groaned, closing her eyes.
"Someone could have been hurt, Wayne."
"Now, that ain't right at all. Someone was hurt. That fat fellow what has no hair."
She massaged her temples.
"You realize I'm a constable now, Wayne? I can't turn a blind eye toward wanton property damage."
"Aw, it's not so bad," Wayne said, still rummaging. "Wax'll pay for it."
"And if someone had been hurt? Seriously, I mean?"
Wayne kept searching.
"The lads got a little carried away. See that the church is flooded, I told them. Meant for the priest to open the place in the morning and find his plumbing had gotten a little case of the being all busted up and leaking all over the rusting place. But the lads, they got a little excited is all. The lads? Just some friends. Saboteurs? Nah, Wayne said. You think they could pronounce that? Wayne. I slapped him around already, Marisy, Wayne said. Promise I did.
He's going to figure it out, Marisy said. What will you do then?
Nah, you're wrong, Wayne said, finally coming out of the cupboard with a large glass jug. Wax has a blind spot for things like this. In the back of his noggin, he'll be relieved that I stopped the wedding. He'll figure it was me, deep in his subcontinence, and will pay for the damages, no matter what the assessor says. And he won't say anything. Won't even investigate. Watch.
I don't know.
Wayne hopped up onto the kitchen counter, then patted the spot beside him. She regarded him for a moment, then sighed and settled onto the counter there. He offered her the jug.
That's cooking sherry, Wayne.
Yeah, he said. Hobbs don't serve anything this hour but beer. A fellow has to get creative.
I'm sure we could find some wine around.
He took a swig.
Never mind, Marisy said.
He lowered the jug and pulled off his chef's hat, tossing it onto the counter.
What are you so uptight for today, anyway? I figured you'd be whooping for joy and running around the street picking flowers and stuff. He's not marrying her. Not yet, anyway. You still got a chance.
I don't want a chance, Wayne. He's made his decision.
Now, what kind of talk is that? He demanded. You've given up? Is that how the Ascendant Warrior was? Huh?
No, in fact, Marisy said.
She walked up to the man she wanted, slapped the book out of his hand, and kissed him.
See? There's how it is.
Though the Ascendant Warrior also went on and murdered the woman Elland was planning to marry.
What? Really?
Yeah.
Gruesome,
Wayne said in an approving tone, then took another swig of sherry.
That's not the half of it, Marisy said, leaning back on the counter, hands behind her. You want gruesome? She also supposedly ripped out the Lord Ruler's insides. I've seen it depicted in several illuminated manuscripts.
Kind of graphic for a religious-type story.
Actually, they're all like that. I think they have to put in lots of exciting bits to make people read the rest.
Huh.
He seemed disbelieving.
Wayne, haven't you ever read any religious texts?
Sure I have.
Really?
Yeah. Lots of things I read had religious texts in them. Damn, hell, flatulent arslick and git.
She gave him a flat stare.
That last one is in the testimony of Hammond. Promise. Least all the letters are.
Another swig. Wayne could outdrink anyone she knew. Of course, that was mostly because he could tap his metal mind, heal himself, and burn away the alcohol's effects in an eye blink. Then start over.
Here now, he continued. That's what you've got to do. Be like the Lady Mistborn. Get your murdering on, see? Don't back down. He should be yours, and you got to let people know.
My murdering on?
Sure.
Against my sister.
You could be polite about it, Wayne said. Like give her the first stab or whatnot.
No, thank you.
It doesn't have to be real murdering, Marisy, Wayne said, hopping off the counter. It can be figurative and all. But you should fight. Don't let him marry her.
Marisy leaned her head back, looking up at the set of ladles swinging above the counter.
I'm not the Ascendant Warrior, Wayne, she said, and I don't particularly care to be. I don't want someone I have to convince, someone I have to rope into submission. That sort of thing is for the courtroom, not the bedroom.
Now, see, I think some people would say,
careful.
That's a right enlightened way to think of things.
He took a swig of sherry.
I'm not some tortured, abandoned creature, Wayne, Marisy said, finding herself smiling at her distorted reflection in a ladle. I'm not sitting around pining and dreaming for someone else to decide if I should be happy. There's nothing there.
Whether that's due to actual lack of affection on his part, or more to stubbornness, I don't care. I've moved on.
She looked down, meeting Wayne's eyes. He cocked his head.
Huh. You're serious, aren't you?
Damn right.
Moved on, he said.
Rusted nuts! You can do that?
Certainly.
Huh. You think I should, you know, Renette?
Wayne, if ever someone should have taken a hint, it was you. Yes. Move on. Really.
Oh, I took the hint, he said, taking a swig of sherry. Just can't remember which jacket I left it in.
He looked down at the jug.
You sure?
She has a girlfriend, Wayne.
It's only a phase, he mumbled. One what lasted 15 years.
He set the jug down, then sighed and reached into the cupboard from before, taking out a bottle of wine.
Oh, for preservation's sake, Marcy said. That was in there all along?
Tastes better if'n you drink something what tastes like dishwater first,
Wayne said, then pulled the cork out with his teeth, which was kind of impressive, she had to admit. He poured her a cup, then one for himself.
To moving on? He asked.
Sure. To moving on.
She raised her cup and saw reflected in the wine someone standing behind her. She gasped, spinning, reaching for her purse. Wayne just raised his cup to the newcomer, who rounded the counter with a slow step. It was the man in the brown suit and bow tie. No, not the man. The Chandra.
If you're here to persuade me to persuade him, Wayne said, you should know that he doesn't ever listen to me unless he's pretty drunk at the time.
He downed the wine.
It's probably why he's lived so long.
Actually, the Chandra said, I'm not here for you.
He turned to Marcy, then tipped his head.
My first choice for this endeavor has rejected my request. I hope you don't take offense at being my second.
Marcy found her heart thumping quickly.
What do you want?
The Chandra smiled broadly.
Tell me, Miss Combs, what do you know about the nature of investiture and identity?
3. Wax, at least, had a change of clothing that wasn't wet. The suit he had worn on the raid. So he was pleasantly dry as his carriage pulled up to Ladrian Mansion. Steris had returned to her father's house to recover. Wax put aside his broadsheet and waited for Cobb, the new coachman, to hop down and yank open the carriage door. There was a frantic eagerness to the little man's motions, as if he knew that Wax only used a coach for propriety's sake. Leaping home on lines of steel would have been far faster, but just as a lord couldn't walk everywhere, steel pushing around town too much in the daytime when not chasing criminals made members of his house uncomfortable. It simply wasn't what a house lord did. Wax nodded to Cobb and handed him the broadsheet. Cobb grinned. He loved the things.
Take the rest of the day off, Wax told him. I know you were looking forward to the wedding festivities.
Cobb's grin widened, then he bobbed his head and climbed back onto the coach to see it and the horses cared for before leaving. He'd likely spend the day at the races. Wax sighed, climbing the steps to the mansion. It was one of the finest in the city. Luxurious, with carved stonework and deep hardwood with tasteful marble accents. That didn't stop it from being a prison. It was just a very nice one. Wax didn't enter. Instead, he stood on the steps for a while before turning around and sitting on them. Closing his eyes, he let it all settle on him. He was good at hiding his scars. He'd been shot almost a dozen times now, a few of those wounds quite bad. Out in the roughs, he'd learned to pick himself up and keep on going no matter what happened. At the same time, it felt like things back then had been simple. Not always easy, but simple. And some scars continued to ache, seemed to get worse with time. He rose with a groan, legs stiff, and continued up the steps. Nobody opened the door for him or took his coat as he entered. He maintained a small staff in the house, but only what he considered necessary. Too many servants, and they'd hover and worry when he did anything on his own. It was as if the idea of him being capable drove them into feeling vestigial. Wax frowned, then slipped Vindication from his hip holster and raised her beside his head. He couldn't say precisely what had set him off. Footsteps up above when he'd given the housekeepers the day off. A cup on a side table with a bit of wine in the bottom. He flicked a little vial from his belt and downed the contents. Steel flakes suspended in whiskey. The metal burned a familiar warmth inside of him, radiating from his stomach, and blue lines sprang into existence around him. They moved with him as he crept forward, as if he were tied with 1,000 tiny threads. He leaped and pushed on the inlays in the marble floor, soaring up alongside the stairs to the second-story viewing balcony above the grand entryway. He slipped easily over the banister, landing with gun at the ready. The door to his study quivered, then opened. Wax tiptoed forward.
"Just a moment, I..."
The man in the light brown suit froze as he found Wax's gun pressed against his temple.
"You," Wax said. "I'm quite fond of this skull," the conjurer remarked. "It's 6th century antiverdant, the head of a metal merchant from Urto, whose grave was shifted and protected as a side effect of Harmony's rebuilding. An antique, if you will. If you make a hole in it, I'll be rather put out."
"I told you I wasn't interested," Wax growled.
"Yes, I took that to heart, Lord Ladrian."
"Then why are you here?"
"Because I was invited," the conjurer said.
He reached up and grasped the barrel of Wax's gun between two fingers, then pushed it gently to the side.
"We needed a place to converse. Your associate suggested it, as, I'm told, the servants are away."
"My associate?"
At that point he heard laughter from ahead.
"Wayne."
He eyed the conjurer, then sighed and slipped his gun into its holster.
"Which one are you? Tensoon, is that you?"
"Me?" the conjurer asked, laughing. "Tensoon? What, do you hear me panting?"
He chuckled, gesturing for Wax to enter his own study as if he were doing Wax some grand courtesy.
"I am Vandel, of the 6th. Pleased to meet you, Lord Ladrian. If you must shoot me, please do it in the left leg, as I've no particular fondness for those bones."
"I'm not going to shoot you," Wax said, shoving past the conjurer and entering the room. The blinds had been drawn, and the thick curtains left to droop down, plunging the room into almost complete darkness, save for two small new electric lamps. Why the closed curtains? Was the conjurer that concerned about being seen? Wayne lounged in Wax's easy chair, feet up on the cocktail table, helping himself to a bowl of walnuts. A woman stretched out in a similar posture in the companion chair, wearing tight trousers and a loose blouse, eyes closed as she leaned back in the chair, hands behind her head. She wore a different body from last time Wax had seen her, but the posture, and the height, gave him good clues that this was Milan. Marisi was inspecting some odd equipment set up on a pedestal at the back of the room. It was a box with small lenses on the front. She stood up straight as soon as she saw him and, being Marisi, blushed deeply.
"Sorry about this," she said. "We were going to go to my flat to talk, but Wayne insisted."
"Needed some nuts," Wayne said around a mouthful of walnuts. "When you invited me to stay here, you did say to make myself at home, mate."
"I'm still unclear as to why you needed a place to talk," Wax said. "I said I wasn't going to help."
"Quite so," Vandel said from the doorway. "As you were unavailable, of necessity, I turned to other options. Lady Combs has been so kind as to listen to my proposition."
"Marisi?" Wax asked.
"You went to Marisi?"
"What?"
Vandel asked. "That's surprising to you? She was instrumental in the defeat of Miles' 100 lives, not to mention her help during the riots Pa'am instigated."
Wax looked at the conjurer. "You're trying to get to me through another route, aren't you?"
"Look who's full of himself," Milan said from her chair.
"He's always full of himself," Wayne said, cracking a walnut. "Mostly on account of him eating his own fingernails. I seen him do it."
"Is it so ridiculous," Marisi said, "that they'd actually want my help?"
"I'm sorry. I didn't mean it that way," Wax said, turning to her.
Then what way did you mean it?
Wax sighed. I don't know, Maracy. It's been a long day. I got shot at, got a water tower dumped in my head, and had my wedding fall apart. Now Wayne is dropping broken walnut shells all over my chair. Honestly, I think I just need a drink.
He walked around the bar at the back of the room. Maracy eyed him, and as he passed, she muttered,
Will you get me one, too? Because this is all making me go a little crazy.
He smiled, digging out some single malt whiskey, pouring for himself and for Maracy. Vendel disappeared out the door, but returned a few minutes later with some piece of equipment that he hooked to the strange device. He ran a wire from the device to one of the wall lamps, pulling out the bulb and screwing in the end of the wire instead. Leaving would feel childish, so Wax leaned against the wall and sipped his whiskey, saying nothing as Vendel turned on his machine. An image appeared on the wall. Wax froze. It was a picture, similar to an Evanotype, only on the wall and quite large. It displayed the Field of Rebirth in the center of Ellendale, where the tombs of Vin and Elend Venture would be found. He'd never seen anything like that image. It seemed to have been created entirely by light. Maracy gasped. Wayne threw a walnut at it.
What? He said as the others glared at him. Wanted to see if it was real.
He hesitated, then threw another walnut. The nut made a shadow on the image where it moved between the device and the wall. So it was light.
Image projector, Vendel said. They call it an evanoscope. By next year, these will be commonplace, I should think.
He paused.
Harmony implies that if we find this wondrous, it will really burn our metals when the images start moving.
Moving? Wax said, stepping forward. How would they do that?
We don't know, Milan said with a grimace. He accidentally let it slip, but won't say anything more.
How does God, Maracy asked, still staring at the image, accidentally let something slip? As I said, Vendel said, he has been distracted lately. We've tried to tease out more regarding moving images, but so far, no luck. He's often like this. Says it's vital that we discover things on our own.
Like a chick breaking out of its shell, Milan said. He says that if we don't struggle and learn on our own, we won't be strong enough to survive what is coming.
She left the words hanging in the room, and Wax shared a look with Maracy.
Well, Maracy said slowly, that's ominous. Has he said anything more about Trell?
Wax folded his arms. Trell. It was a god from the old records, long before the Catasandra. Indeed, long before the Lord Ruler. Harmony had memorized this religion, with many others, during his days as a mortal. Maracy had an obsession with the god, and one that was not unwarranted. Wax wasn't certain whether her claim was true or not, that the worship of Trell was involved in what had happened to Lessie, but the spikes they'd discovered, they didn't seem to have been made of any metal known to man. The Chondra had confiscated those. Wax had been so deep in his sorrows that by the time he'd started to recover, they'd already been taken.
No, Vendel said, and I have no update on the spikes, if that's what you're wondering, but this task I have for you, Miss Combs, might provide insight. Suffice it to say, we're worried about the possible intrusion of another god upon this domain.
Hey, Milan said, what's a girl gotta do to get some of that whiskey?
Sister, Vendel said, twisting something on his machine, making the image brighter. You are a representative of Harmony and his enlightenment.
Yup,
Milan said.
And I'm a tragically sober one.
Wax brought her a glass, and she grinned at him in thanks.
Chivalry,
she said, raising it.
Manipulation, Vendel said. Miss Combs, I spoke to you earlier of investiture and identity. I promised you an explanation. Here.
He flipped something on his machine, changing the image on the wall to a list of ferrochemical metals, their attributes, and their natures. It wasn't the pretty artistic rendition that Wax often saw in popular lore. It was far less fancy, but much more detailed.
The basic physical abilities of ferrochemy are well understood,
Vendel said, walking forward and using a long reed to point at a section of the projected chart.
Terrace tradition and heritage has explored them for at least 1,500 years. Harmony left detailed explanations in the words of founding. Likewise, the abilities in the so-called mental quadrant of the chart have been outlined and discussed, tested and defined. Our understanding doesn't reach as far here. We don't know why memories stored in a metal mind degrade the way they do when removed, or why tapping mental speed tends to make one hungry, of all things. But still, we have a great deal of experience in this area.
He paused, and circled his pointer around a group of medals and abilities at the bottom. Fortune, investiture, identity, and connection. Wax leaned forward. They'd spoken of these during his year living in the village, but only as part of the catechisms of Ferrochemy and Terrace belief. None of these specified what the powers actually did. They were considered beyond understanding, like God or time.
Chromium, Vendel said. Nicrosil, aluminum, duralumin. These aren't metals that most ancients knew. Only in recent times have modern metallurgical processes allowed them to become commonplace.
Commonplace, Wayne said. With a single aluminum bullet, mate, I could buy you an outfit that don't look so stupid, and have money left over for a nice hat or two.
Be that as it may, Vendel said, compared to the amount of aluminum in the world before the Catasandra, the metal is now common. Bauxite refining, modern chemical processes, these have given us access to metals on a level that was never before possible. Why, the last obligator's autobiography explains that early aluminum was harvested from the inside of the ash mounts.
Wax stepped forward along the cone of light emanating from the machine. So what do they do?
Research is ongoing, Vendel said. Fairings with these abilities are very, very rare, and it is only in the last few decades that we've had access to enough of these metals to begin experimenting. Rebuilding society has been a wearisome process.
You were alive before, Marcy said, in the days of the Ascendant Warrior.
Vendel turned, raising his eyebrows.
Indeed, though I never met her. Only Tensun did.
What was life like? Marcy asked.
Hard, Vendel said. It was hard.
There are holes in our memories, Milan added softly, from when our spikes were removed. It took a piece out of us. There are things we'll never get back.
Wax took a drink. There was a weight that came from speaking to the Chondra, in realizing that most of them had already been alive for hundreds of years when the world of ash had ended. These were ancient beings. Perhaps Wax should not be surprised by their presumption. To them, he, indeed everyone else alive, was little more than a child.
Identity,
Vendel said, slapping his reed against the wall, casting a shadow on the image.
Lord Ladrian, could another ferrochemist use your metal mines?
Of course not, Wax said. Everyone knows that.
Why?
Well, because they're mine. Ferrochemy was simple, elegant. Fill your metal mind with an attribute for an hour, like Wax's weight or Wayne's health and healing, and you could draw out an hour's worth of that attribute later on. Alternatively, you could draw out a burst of power that was extremely intense but lasted only a moment.
The raw power of both allomancy and ferrochemy, Vendel said, is something we call investiture. This is very important. As in ferrochemy, an individual's investiture is keyed specifically to them, to what we call identity.
You've made me curious, Wax said, looking at the wall as Vendel leisurely walked back to his machine. How does it know? My metal mines, do they recognize me?
After a fashion, Vendel said, changing the image to one of a ferrochemist tapping strength.
The woman's muscles had grown to several times their normal size as she lifted a horse above her head.
Each man or woman has a spiritual aspect, a piece of themselves that exists in another realm entirely. You might call it your soul. Your investiture is keyed to your soul. Indeed, it might be a part of your soul, much as your blood is a part of your body.
So if a person could store their identity, Marcy said, as Waxillium does with his weight... They'd be without it for a time, Vendel said. A blank slate, so to speak. So they could use anyone's metal mind? Marcy asked.
Possibly, Vendel said.
He cycled through pictures of several more ferrochemists using their abilities before coming to rest on an image of a set of bracers. Simple metal bands, like wide bracelets, meant to be worn on the upper arms beneath clothing. It was impossible to tell the type of metal without color, but they had ancient terrace markings engraved on them.
Some have been experimenting with your idea, Vendel said, and early results are promising. However, having a ferrochemist who can use anyone's metal minds is intriguing, but not particularly life-changing. Our society is strewn with individuals who have extraordinary abilities. This would simply be one more variety. No. What interests me is the opposite, Miss Combs. What if a ferrochemist were to divest himself of all identity, then fill another metal mind with an attribute, say, strength? What would it do?
Create an unkeyed metal mind? Marcy asked. One that another ferrochemist could access?
Possibly, Vendel said. Or is there another possibility? Most people living right now have at least some ferrochemist blood in them. Could it be that such a metal mind as I described, one that is keyed to no single individual, might be usable by anyone?
Understanding settled on Wax like a slowly burned metal. From the chair beside the image device, Wayne whistled slowly.
Anyone could be a ferrochemist, Wax said.
Vendel nodded.
Investiture. The innate ability to burn metals or tap metal mines is also one of the things ferrochemy can store. Lord Waxillium, these are arts we are only beginning to comprehend, but the secrets they contain could change the world. In the ancient days, the last emperor discovered a metal that transformed him into a mistborn. A metal anyone could burn, it is said. This whispers of a hidden possibility, something lesser but still incredible. What if one could somehow manipulate identity and investiture to create a set of bracers which imparted ferrochemical or allomantic ability upon the person wearing them? One could make any person a mistborn or a ferrochemist, or both at once.
The room fell silent. A walnut bounced off Vendel's head. He immediately turned to glare at Wayne.
Sorry, Wayne said. Just had trouble believing someone could be so melodramatic, so I figured you might not be real. Had a check, you know.
Vendel rubbed his forehead, breathing out sharply in annoyance.
This is all fascinating, Wax admitted, but unfortunately it's also impossible.
And why is that? Vendel asked.
You don't even know how or if this would work, Wax said, waving toward the screen. And even if you could figure it out, you'd need a full ferrochemist, someone with at least two ferrochemical powers, as they'd need to be able to store their identity in a metal mind along with another ferrochemical attribute.
Rust, to do what you proposed a moment ago and create allomancers too, you'd basically need someone who was already both mistborn and full ferrochemist.
This is true, Vendel said.
And how long has it been since a full ferrochemist was born?
A very, very long time, Vendel said. But being born a ferrochemist isn't the only way to make this happen.
Wax hesitated, then shared a look with Marcy. She nodded, and he strode across the room to pull back the wooden panel hiding his wall safe. He did the combination and removed the book that Iron Eyes had sent him. He turned, raising it.
Hemallergy? Harmony hates it. I've read what the Lord Mistborn had to say on the topic.
Yes, Vendel said. Hemallergy is problematic.
In part because we wouldn't exist without it, Milan said. That's not a particularly fun thing to know. that people had to be murdered in order to bring you to sapience.
Creating new spikes is a horrid practice, Vendel agreed. We have no intentions of doing such a thing to experiment with identity. Instead, we're waiting. A full ferrochemist is bound to be born among mankind eventually, particularly with the Terrace elite working so hard to preserve and condense their bloodlines. Unfortunately, our restraint will not be shared by everyone. There are those who are growing very close to understanding how all this works.
My uncle, Wax thought, looking down at the book in his fingers. So far as he could tell, Edworn, the man known as Mr. Suit, was trying to breed allomancers. What would he do with hemallergy if he knew about it?
We need to stay ahead of those who might use this for ill purposes, Vendel said. We need to experiment and determine how these identity-free metal mines would work.
Doing so will be dangerous, Wax said. Mixing the powers is incredibly dangerous,
says the twin-born, Milan said.
I'm safe, Wax said, glancing at her. My powers don't compound. They're from different metals.
They may not compound, Vendel said, but they're still fascinating, Lord Waxillium. Any mixing of allomancy and ferrochemy has unanticipated effects.
What is it about you, Wax said, that makes me want to punch you even when you're saying something helpful?
None of us have been able to figure it out,
Milan said, waving for Wayne to toss her a walnut.
One of the Cosmere's great mysteries.
Now, Lord Ladrian, Vendel said, holding up his hands. Is that the way to speak to someone who bears your ancestor's hands?
His hands? Wax said. Are you speaking metaphorically?
No, Vendel said. Breeze did say I could have them after he died. Excellent metacarpals. I bring them out for special occasions.
Wax stood still for a moment, holding the book in his hand, trying to digest what the Chondra had just said. His ancestor, the first Lord Ladrian, Counselor of Gods, had given this creature his hands. In a way, Wax had shaken hands with Breeze's corpse. He stared at his glass, surprised to find it empty, and poured some more whiskey.
"This has been a very enlightening lesson," Marisi said. "But pardon, Your Holiness, you still haven't explained what you need from me."
Vendel changed the picture to one of an illustration. A man with long dark hair and a bare chest wearing a cloak that extended behind him into eternity. His arms, crossed before him, were wrapped with intricate bracers in a fanciful design. Wax recognized the iconography, if not the specific image. Rashik, the first emperor. The Lord Ruler.
What do you know of the Bands of Mourning, Miss Combs? Vendel asked.
The Lord Ruler's metal mines, Marisi said with a shrug. Relics from mythology, like the Lady Mistborn's knives or the Lance of the Fountains.
There are four individuals, Vendel said, who, to our knowledge, have held the power of ascension. Rashik, the survivor, the ascendant warrior, and Lord Harmony himself. Harmony's ascension granted him a precise and in-depth knowledge of the metallic arts. It stands to reason that the Lord Ruler gained the same information. He understood identity as a ferrochemical ability, and knew the hidden metals. Indeed, he gave aluminum to his inquisitors.
Vendel flipped the image to a more detailed illustration of those arms wrapped in bands of metal.
Curiously, nobody knows exactly what happened to the Bands of Mourning. Back when the Lord Ruler fell, Tensun had not yet joined the Ascendant Warrior, and though he swears he heard them mentioned, the holes in his memory prevent him from saying how or when. The mythology surrounding the Bands is quite extensive. You can find myths about them dating back to before the Katasandra, and you can find someone telling new ones in a pub around the corner invented on the spot for your amusement. But a theme runs through them all. If you held the Lord Ruler's bracers, you supposedly gained his powers.
That's just fancy, Wax said. It's a natural thing to wish for, to make stories about. It doesn't mean anything.
Doesn't it? Vendel asked. Lore says the bands have the very power that science has only now determined is plausible to assemble.
Coincidence, Wax said. And just because he might have created something doesn't mean he did. And just because you think identity works like you say doesn't mean you're right. Besides, the bands would have been destroyed when Harmony remade the world. And that's not even considering that it would be foolish for the Lord Ruler to create weapons someone else could use against him. Vendel clicked his machine. The image changed to another Ivanotype, this one of a mural on a wall. It depicted a room with a central dais in the shape of a truncated pyramid. Set upon a pedestal on the dais was a pair of bracers made of delicate, curling metal, shaped in spirals. Only a mural, but it did seem like it was depicting the bands of mourning.
What is that? Maracy asked.
One of our brothers, Milan said, sitting up in her chair. A Chondra named Rilur took this image.
The bands of mourning fascinated him, Vendel said. Rilur spent the last 2 centuries chasing them. He recently returned to Elendel bearing an Ivanotype camera in his pack and these pictures.
Vendel clicked to the next image, a picture of a large metal plate set into a wall and inscribed with a strange script. Wax narrowed his eyes.
I don't know that language.
Nobody does, Vendel said. It's completely alien to us, unrelated to any Terrace, Imperial, or other route. Even the old languages in Harmony's records bear no resemblance to this script.
Wax felt a chill as the images continued. Another shot of the strange language. A statue that resembled the Lord Ruler bearing a long spear. This appeared to be covered in frost. Another shot of the mural, more detailed, which depicted bracers with many different metals twining together. Not bracers for a fairing like Wax, but bracers for a full ferrochemist. Only a mural, yes, but it was compelling.
Rilur believed in the bands, Vendel said. He claims to have seen them, though his camera bore no image of the actual relics. I'm inclined to trust his words.
Vendel showed another image of a different mural. It depicted a man standing atop a peak, hands raised above him, and a glowing spear hovering there, just beyond his touch. A corpse slumped at his feet. Wax went forward, walking into the stream of light until he was standing right in front of the image, looking up at the portion he wasn't blocking. The face of the man in the mosaic had eyes upturned and lips parted as if in awe at what he held. He wore the bracers on his arms. Wax turned around, but standing in the stream of light, he couldn't see anything in the room.
You mean to tell me your brother, this Rilur, actually found the bands of mourning?
He found something, Vendel said.
Where?
He doesn't know, Vendel said softly.
Wax stepped out of the light, frowning. He looked from Vendel to Milan.
What?
He asked them.
He's missing a spike, Milan said. Best we could determine, he was accosted before he could return here from the mountains near the southern roughs.
We can't get any straight answers out of him, Vendel said. A Chondra with a missing spike. Well, they aren't quite sane any longer, as you well know.
Wax shivered, a pit of emptiness shifting inside him.
Yes.
So, Miss Combs, Vendel said, stepping away from his machine. This is where you come in. Rilur is one of our finest. Of the 3rd generation, he is an explorer, an expert at bodies, and a genius. Losing him would be a great blow to us.
We can't reproduce, Milan said. Our numbers are set. The 3rd's like Rilur. They're our parents, our exemplars, our leaders. He is precious.
We would like you to recover his spike, Vendel said. from whoever took it. This will restore his sanity and hopefully his memories.
The longer he goes without it, the bigger the holes will be,
Milan said.
So perhaps you can understand our urgency, Vendel said, and why I found it prudent to interrupt Lord Ladrian even on what was obviously an important day. When Rilur returned to us, he was missing an entire arm and half his chest. Though he will not, or cannot, speak of where he got these pictures, he is able to recall being attacked in New Seren. We believe someone ambushed him there on his return and stole the artifacts he had discovered.
They have his spike, Milan said, voice tense. It's still there. It has to be.
Wait, wait, Marcy said. Why not give him another spike? You've got enough of them lying around to make earrings like the one you gave Waxillium.
The two Chondra looked at her as if she were mad, but Wax couldn't see why. He thought the question was an excellent one.
You are misunderstanding the nature of these spikes, Vendel all but sputtered. First, we do not have Chondra blessings lying around. The earrings you mention are crafted from old Inquisitor spikes, and have barely any potency to them. One might have been good enough for Lord Waxillium's little stunt 6 months ago, but they would hardly be enough to restore a Chondra.
Yeah, Milan said. If that worked, we'd have already used all those spikes to make new children. We can't. A Chondra blessing must be created very specifically.
We did try something akin to what you suggest, Vendel admitted. Tensun relinquished one of his own spikes to give our fallen brother a few minutes of lucidity. It was very painful for Tensun and, unfortunately, accomplished nothing. Rilur only screamed, begging for his spike. He spat out Tensun's a moment later. Trying to use someone else's spikes when you don't have your own already can provoke radical changes in personality, memory, and temperament.
Lessie, Wax said, voice hoarse.
She changed spikes frequently.
And each was a spike created specifically for her, Vendel said. Not one that had been used by another Chondra. And besides, would you call her particularly stable, Lord Waxillium? You must trust us on this. We have done what we can. Here, at least. Milan will be traveling to New Seren to investigate and retrieve Rilur's missing spike. Miss Combs, we would like you to join her and help recover our brother's mind. We can intervene with your superiors in the constable precinct and make certain you are assigned field duty working for the government in a clandestine fashion. If you can restore Rilur's spike, we will be able to find answers.
Vendel eyed Wax.
This will not be a wild hunt for some impossible artifact. All we want is our friend back. Of course, any clues you can discover regarding where he went on his quest and where he got these pictures would be appreciated. There are some people of interest in New Seren, nobility that Rilur is fixated upon for reasons we can't get out of him.
Wax studied the last image for a time longer. It was tempting. Mystical artifacts were all well and good, but someone attacking, and nearly killing, one of the faceless immortals? That was interesting.
I'll go, Marcy said from behind him. I'll do it.
But I wouldn't mind help. Waxillium?
A part of him longed to go. Escape the parties and the dances, the political engagements and business meetings. The Chondra would know that. Harmony would know that. Anger simmered deep within him at the thought. He'd hunted Lessie, and they hadn't told him.
This sounds like the perfect challenge for your skills, Marcy, he found himself saying. I doubt you need me. You are perfectly capable, and I feel a fool for having implied otherwise, even accidentally. If you do want company, however, perhaps Wayne would be willing to provide some extra protection. I'm afraid that I, however, must...
The image on the wall flickered to a shot of a city with grand waterfalls. New Seren? He'd never been there. The streets were overgrown with foliage, and people promenaded about in clothing of striped brown suits and soft white dresses.
Ah, I forgot, Vendel said. There was one other image in Relure's belongings. We discovered it last, as the others were packed carefully away to await development. We suspect this image was taken in Nusaren just before the attack.
And why should I care? Wax said. It...
He trailed off, feeling an icy shock as he recognized someone in the picture. He stepped back into the stream of light, pressing his hand against the white wall, trying, fruitlessly, to feel the image.
Impossible.
She stood between two men, who held to her arms tightly as if pulling her forward against her will, keeping her prisoner even in broad daylight. She had glanced over her shoulder toward the camera as the Avanotype was taken. It must be one of the new models he'd been hearing about that didn't require the subject to stand still for the image to set. The woman was in her 40s, lean but solid, with long dark hair framing a face that, despite their years apart, Wax knew very, very well. Telson. His sister. 4. 2 hours after the strange meeting, Wayne puttered through Wax's mansion, peeking behind pictures, lifting up vases. Where did he keep the good stuff? It is her, Steris, Wax was saying in the ground floor sitting room, not far away. And that man with his back turned, holding her by the arm, that could be my uncle. They're involved in this. I have to go. It had always seemed funny to Wayne how rich folk got to decide what was valuable. He inspected a picture frame that was likely pure gold. Why did anyone care about this shiny stuff? Gold could do some fun things with ferrochemy, but it was pure rubbish when it came to alomancy. Well, rich folk liked it, so they paid a lot for it, and that made it valuable. No other reason. How did they decide what was valuable? Did they all just gather together, sit around in their suits and gowns, and say, "Oi, let's start eating fish eggs and make the stuff real expensive. That'll rust their brains at will." Then they'd have a nice round of rich folks' laughter and throw some servants off the top of a building to see what kind of splats they'd make when they hit. Wayne put the picture back. He refused to play by rich people's rules. He'd decide for himself what something was worth, and that frame was ugly. Didn't help none that Steris's cousins, who were depicted in the Avanotype it held, looked like fish.
"Then you should most certainly go, Lord Waxillium," Steris said. "Why the concern? We can make arrangements to postpone other duties."
"It's infuriating, Steris."
Even from out in the hall, Wayne could hear the "I'm pacing" in his tone. "Not a word of apology, from them or Harmony, regarding what they did to me." Vendel made offhanded comments, referring to me shooting Lessie as a stunt. "They used me. Lessie was only trying in a broken way to free me from them. Now they saunter back, no mention of what I lost, and expect me to just pick up and do their bidding again." Poor Wax. That had busted him up right good, it had. And Wayne could see why. Still, an apology? Did people what got killed in a flood expect an apology from God? God did as God wished. You simply hoped to not get on his worst side. Kind of like the bouncer at the club with the pretty sister. Harmony wasn't the only god, anyway, and that was what Wayne was about today. After some silence, Wax continued more softly.
"I have to go. Even after what they did, if my uncle is really involved in this, if I can free Telson, I have to go. Tomorrow night there will be a gathering of the Outer City's political elite in Nusaren. Governor Aradel is rightly concerned and was going to send a representative anyway. It gives me a plausible excuse to be in the city. Marisi can look for the lost spike. I can hunt down my uncle."
"It is decided, then," Steris said. "Will we be leaving immediately?"
Wax was silent for a moment.
"We?"
"I assumed. I mean, if you are taking my sister, it would look very odd if I were not accompanying you."
Wayne felt like he could hear her blush.
"I don't mean to be presumptuous. You may, of course, do as you wish, but—"
"No," he said. "You're right. It would look odd to go alone. The gathering will include a reception, after all. I don't want to imply—I mean,
I can go, but stay out of your way.
It could be dangerous. I can't ask it of you.
If this is what you feel you must do, then I will be happy to take the risk.
I... Rusts? Those two were as awkward as a man suddenly splitting his cheeks in church.
Wayne shook his head, picking up one of the vases in the entryway.
Good pottery, with a nice swirly-durly pattern. Maybe that would do for his offering.
Someone knocked on the door, and Wayne put the vase back. It didn't feel right. He took one of the flowers, though, and traded it for an extra sock from his back pocket.
Huh.
He had a silverware set in his other pocket. From the wedding breakfast? Yeah, that was right. They'd put out a place setting for him, had his name and everything. That meant the silverware had been his. He put the fork, knife, and spoon back in his pocket and tucked the flower behind his ear, then walked to the door, reaching it right before that butler did. He gave the man a glare. It was only a matter of time before he cracked and tried to kill them all, then pulled open the door. That Condra bloke stood on the other side. His suit now was an even lighter shade of tan.
You, Wayne said, pointing. We just got rid of you.
It had only been, what, 2 hours since he left?
Good afternoon, young lad, the Condra said. Are the adults home?
Darians quite politely pushed Wayne aside and gestured for Vendel to enter.
You are expected, sir.
He is, Wayne said.
Master Ladrian said to send you in, the butler said, pointing toward the sitting room. Thank you, Vendel said, striding toward the room.
Wayne caught up with him quickly.
Nice flower, the Condra said. Can I have your skeleton when you're dead?
My...
Wayne felt at his head.
You're a bloodmaker, correct? Can heal yourself? Bloodmaker bones tend to be particularly interesting, as your time spent weak and sickly creates oddities in your joints and bones that can be quite distinctive. I'd love to have your skeleton, if you don't mind.
Taken aback by this request, Wayne stopped in place. Then he ran past him, pushing into the room where Wax and Steris were talking.
Wax! He complained, pointing. The immortal bloke is being creepy again.
Greetings, Lord Ladrian, Vendel said, walking in and holding up a folder. Your tickets, along with transcripts of everything we've been able to pry out of Relure. I warn you, most of it isn't terribly lucid.
Wayne glanced at Wax's liquor cabinet. Maybe something in there would work for what he needed for his offering.
I haven't said that I'd go, Wax told the immortal. You're roping me into this sure as sheep in a pen.
Yes, the immortal said. He held out the folder again. In here is a list of people Relure mentions. You'll find it interesting that he lists several, including the woman holding the party I'm sending you to, as having had interactions with your uncle.
Wax sighed, then accepted it. He gestured to Steris, who had risen to curtsy.
My fiancée. We were debating whether she should accompany me or not.
We have made provisions for whatever you decide, Vendel said. Though it will look less suspicious if you go too, Lady Harms, I cannot guarantee your safety.
It might be helpful if you accompanied us, Vendel, Wax said. We could use an extra metalborn.
Vendel's eyes bulged, and he turned white, like he'd been told his baby had been born with two noses.
Go out into the field? Me? Lord Ladrian, I assure you, that's not what you want.
Why not? Wax asked, leaning back against the wall. You're practically impossible to kill, and you can change your rusting shape into anything you want.
Wait, Wayne said, turning away from the liquor cabinet. You can turn into anything? Like a bunny?
Very small animals are extremely difficult, as we need a certain mass to hold our cognitive functions and...
Bunny! Wayne said. Can you be a bunny?
If absolutely necessary.
So that's what that damn book was about.
Vendel sighed, looking toward Wax.
Milan can perform any transformations you might need. I honor the first contract, Lord Ladrian. Besides, the outside doesn't suit me. There's too much...
He waved his hands in front of him. Too much what? Wax asked, frowning.
Everything, Vendel said.
though Wayne didn't miss that the rusting bunny glanced at him when he said it. Wayne shook his head, trying the liquor cabinet. It was locked, unfortunately. What a fine heap of trust Wax showed in him.
"My sister will meet you at the station," Vendel said. "Track 17, in 4 hours."
4 hours?
Steris said.
"I need to send for the maids, and the valet, and—"
She raised a hand to her head, looking faint.
"And I need to make a list."
"We'll be there, Vendel," Wax said.
"Excellent," the Condra fellow said, fishing in his pocket.
Wayne got interested until he came out with a dull old bent earring. Simple, old style.
"I brought you one of these."
"No thanks."
"But if you need to—"
"No thanks," Wax said. The look between the two of them grew real uncomfortable, like each was accusing the other of having made an unpersonable stench of some sort.
"Good, good,"
Wayne said, drifting toward the door.
"Meet you all at the station."
"Aren't you going to pack?"
Steris called after him.
"Sex in my room," Wayne called back. "Under my bed. I'm always packed and ready to go, mate. Never can tell when a misunderstanding will crop up."
He turned away, popped his hat off the rack, flipped it onto his head, and ducked out the front door. Leave them to their discussing and their arguing and their creepy immortal bunnies. He had things that needed to be done. Well, one thing at least. Wayne had a quest. He whistled as he danced down the steps. A simple tune, easy and familiar, with an accompanying beat playing in his mind. Ba-bum, ba-bum, ba-bum. Quick, energetic. He strolled down the street, but found himself less and less pleased with his flower. It was not the proper offering for the god with whom he must meet. Too obvious. Too soft. He spun it in his fingers, thoughtful, softly whistling his tune. No better ideas came to him. This area was too fancy, with mansions and gardens and men clipping hedges. The streets didn't even stink of horse dung. It was hard to think in a place like this. Everyone knew the best thinking happened in alleyways and slums, places where the brain had to be alert, even panicked, or the bugger knew that if it didn't perk up and get some geniusing done, you were likely to get yourself stabbed. And then where would it be? Holding your brain hostage against your own stupidity, that was how to get stuff done. Wayne made his way to a nearby canal and searched out a gondola man who looked bored.
"My good man," Wayne said to himself. "My good man."
Yeah, that was it. Speak like you couldn't breathe right. High first octant accent, with a little terrace stirred in. Rich accent. Very rich.
"You, boatman," Wayne called, waving. "Hey! Oh, do hurry. I haven't the time."
The boatman pulled over.
"Quickly now, quickly, my good man," Wayne shouted. "Tell me, how much for the day?"
"The day?"
the boatman said.
"Yes, yes,"
Wayne said, hopping into the boat.
"I have need of your services for the entire day."
Wayne settled himself without waiting for a response.
"Onward now. Up the 4th-5th canal, turn right around the hub, then east up the iron gate. First stop is in the 3rd octant. She's counting on me, you know."
"The whole day,"
the boatman said, eager.
"Yes, sir, my lord." "Ladrian," Wayne said. "Wexilium Ladrian. We aren't moving. Why aren't we moving?"
The boatman began pulling, so gleeful at the prospect of many hours of employment that he forgot to ask for any money up front.
50,
the man finally said.
"Hmm?"
50, for the whole day.
"Yes, yes, fine," Wayne said.
Dirty thief, he thought, trying to cheat an upstanding citizen and a house lord at that, merely because he acted a little distracted? What was the world coming to? When his grandfather Ladrian had been house lord, men had known how to be respectful. Why, a boatman in those days would have dunked himself in the canal before taking a wuzzing more than he was due.
"If you don't mind me asking, my lord," the boatman said, "and I mean no offense, but your clothing."
"Yes?"
Wayne asked, straightening his rough coat.
"Is something wrong with it?"
"Wrong with it?"
Wayne said, stuffing his accent so full of noble indignation it was practically bleeding.
"Wrong with it? Man, do you not follow fashion?" I. Tompton Delacour himself designed these clothes, Wayne said. Northern Outlands inspiration. It's the height, I tell you, the height! A coin shot couldn't get higher. Sorry, sorry, my lord. I said I didn't want to offend. You can't just say don't be offended and then say something offensive, man. That's not how it works.
Wayne settled back, arms folded. The boatman wisely said nothing more to him. After about 10 minutes of travel, the time had arrived.
No,
Wayne said, as if to himself.
We'll need to stop at Glimmering Point Docks, and then a skid along Stancil Belt.
He let his accent shift, a little of the knobs, a slum slipping in. Dull accent, like a mouth filled with cotton. The folks there used the word skid for practically anything. Distinctive word, that. Skid. Sounded like it should be something dirty.
My lord?
Hmm? Wayne said.
Oh, just going over my errands. My nephew was getting married. You might have heard of the wedding. It's all the talk of the city. So many errands. Yes, indeed, the day will be quite the skid.
That was a ruffian's accent, but just a hint, like the lemon in a good hot toddy. He slipped it in under the highborn accent. The boatman started to get uncomfortable.
You said the Stancil Belt? Not a nice area, that. Need to hire some workers, Wayne said absently.
The boatman continued poling, but he was nervous now, tapping his foot, moving the pole more quickly, ignoring calls from colleagues they passed. Something was wrong. Like the scent of a meat pie left under the sofa for a few days. A whole day's hiring? An outrageous sum? It might instead be a setup. Pretend to be a lord, then lure him into the slums to be robbed?
My lord, the man said. I just realized. Gotta get back. Can't be hired for the whole day. My mother, she'll need me. What nonsense is this? Wayne demanded. I haven't the time for your prattle, man, and catching another boat will waste my precious time. I'll double your fee.
Now the man was really anxious.
Sorry, my lord, he said, pulling to the side of the canal. Very sorry. Can't do it. At least take me to Stancil. No, the man yelped. Nope, can't do it. Gotta go. Well, Wayne huffed, climbing out. I've never been treated in such a manner, and we're not even halfway down Portway. Sorry, my lord, the man said, pulling away as quickly as he could. Sorry.
Wayne cocked his head, grinned, and checked the sign hanging from the street lamp. Exactly where he'd wanted to go. And not a clip paid. He started whistling and strolled along the canal, keeping an eye out for a better offering. What would the god want? Maybe that, he wondered, eyeing a line of people waiting at Old Dent's roadside cart, wanting to buy some of his fried potatoes. Seemed a good bet. Wayne wandered over.
Need some help, Dent?
The old man looked up and wiped his brow.
5 clips a small pouch, 8 for a large, Wayne. And don't eat none of the stock or I'll fry your fingers.
Wayne grinned, slipping behind the cart as the man turned back to his brazier and stirred a batch that was frying. Wayne took the customer's money and didn't eat much of the stock until the last man in line arrived, a fancy-looking fellow in a doorman's jacket. Probably worked at one of the hotels down the lane. Good tips at those jobs.
3 large,
the man said. Wayne got his potatoes, took the man's money, then hesitated.
Actually, Wayne said, holding up a note, do you have change? We got too many large bills.
I suppose, the man said, digging into his nice eel-skin wallet.
Great. Here's a 20.
I've got 2 5s and 10 1s, the man said, putting them down.
Thanks.
Wayne took them, then hesitated.
Actually, I've got plenty of ones. Gotta get that 10 I saw on your wallet.
Fine.
Wayne gave him a handful of coins and took the 10.
Hey, the man said. There are only 7 here.
Whoops, Wayne said.
What are you doing, Wayne?
Old Dent said. There's more change in the box under there.
Really?
Wayne glanced.
Rosts. Okay, how about you just give me my 20 back?
He counted the man back 13 and poured the coins and bills into his hand. The man sighed and gave Wayne the 20.
Can I just get some sauce for my chips?
Sure, sure, Wayne said, squeezing some sauce onto the pouches beside the potatoes. That's a nice wallet. What do you want for it?
The man hesitated, looking at his wallet.
I'll give you this, Wayne said,
plucking the flower off his ear and holding it out with a banknote worth 10. The man shrugged and handed over the empty wallet, taking the bill and stuffing it in his pocket. He threw the flower away.
Idiot, the man said,
marching off with his potatoes. Wayne tossed the wallet up and caught it again.
Did you shortchange that man, Wayne?
Old Dent asked.
What's that?
You got him to give you 50 and you gave him back 40.
What?
Wayne said, stuffing the wallet in his back pocket.
You know I can't count that high, Dent. Sides, gave him 10 extra at the end.
For his wallet.
Nah, Wayne said. The flower was for the wallet. The bill was 'cause I somehow ended up with an extra 10 completely on accident. Very innocent-like.
He smiled, helped himself to a pouch of chips, and went wandering off.
That wallet was nice. His god would like that.
Everyone needed wallets, right? He got it out and opened and closed it repeatedly until he noticed that one side was worn.
Rusts. He'd been cheated. This wouldn't work at all for an offering.
He shook his head, walking along the canal promenade. A pair of urchins sat on one side, hands out for coins. The melancholy sound of a busker rose from a little farther down the path. Wayne was near the breakouts, a nice slum, and he caught whiffs of their distinctive odor. Fortunately, the aroma wafting from a nearby bakery overwhelmed most of it.
"Here's the thing,"
he said to one of the urchins, a girl, not 7. He settled down on his haunches.
"I ain't travailed enough."
"Sir?"
the girl asked.
"In the old stories of quests, you gotta travail. That's like traveling, but with an ailment stapled on. Headaches and the like. Maybe a sore backside, too."
Can I have a coin, sir?"
"Ain't got no coins," Wayne said, thinking. "Damn. In the stories, they always tip the urchins, don't they? Let you know they're the heroes and such. Hold here for a sec."
He stood up and burst into the bakery, real heroic-like. A woman behind the counter was just pulling a rack of meat buns out of the oven. Wayne slammed his fork down onto the plain wooden countertop, leaving it flourished there like a rusting legendary sword.
"How many buns will you give me for this?" he asked.
The baker frowned, looking at him, then taking the fork. She turned it over in her fingers.
"Mister,"
she said,
"this is silver."
"So, how many?"
Wayne asked.
"A bunch."
"A bunch'll do, fair merchant."
A moment later, he emerged from the bakery holding 3 large paper sacks filled with 12 buns each. He dropped a handful of change the baker had insisted on giving him into the urchin's hands, then held up a finger as their jaws dropped.
"You," he said, "must earn this."
"How, sir?"
"Take these," he said, dropping the sacks. "Go give the stuff inside away."
"To who?"
the girl asked.
"Anyone who needs them," Wayne said. "But see here now, don't eat more than 4 yourselves, all right?"
"4?
The girl said.
"All for me?"
"Well, 5. But you bargain hard, little cheat."
He left them stunned and danced along the edge of the canal, passing the busker who sat strumming an old guitar.
"Something lively, minstrel," Wayne called,
tossing the silver spoon into the man's overturned hat, which awaited tips.
"Here now,"
the man said.
"What's this?"
He squinted.
"A spoon? Merchants are apparently desperate for the things," Wayne called. "They'll give you 50 meat buns for one, with change to boot. Now give me the last breath, minstrel."
The man shrugged and started plucking the song from Wayne's mind. Ba-bum, ba-bum, ba-bum. Quick, energetic. Wayne rocked back and forth, eyes closed.
"The end of an era," he thought. "A god to be appeased."
He heard the 2 urchins laughing and opened his eyes to see them tossing meat buns at the people they passed. Wayne smiled, then kicked himself in a smooth skid along the edge of the canal, which was slippery with a coating of slime. He He managed to do a good 10 feet before losing his balance and slipping, which, of course, plunged him right into the canal. Coughing, he pulled himself up onto the side. Well, maybe this would count as a travail. If not, it was probably poetry, considering what he'd done to Wax this morning. He fished out his hat, then put his back to the canal. That was the way to go. Eyes forward, back turned toward the past. No sense getting your nose stuck in things that don't matter anymore. He continued on his way, trailing water and spinning the last of the silverware, the knife, in his fingers. This was not the right offering for his quest. He was pretty sure of it. But what was? He stopped at the next canal bridge, then stepped back. A short man in a uniform he didn't recognize was walking down a nearby street with a little book in hand. Motor cars were parked here in various positions, mostly partly up onto the sidewalks. The man in uniform stopped at each one, writing something down in his book. Wayne followed after him.
"Here now," he asked the man. "What are you doing?"
The little man in the uniform glanced at him, then back at his notebook.
"New city ordinance about the parking of motor cars requires them to be left in an orderly manner, not up on the sidewalks like this."
"So?"
"So I'm writing down the registry numbers of each one," the man said. "And we'll track down the owners and charge them a fine."
Wayne whistled softly.
"That's evil."
"Nonsense," the man said. "It's the law."
"So you're a conner?"
"Fine enforcement officer," the man said. "Spent most of my time inspecting kitchens before last month. This is a lot more productive, I'll tell you. It—"
"That's great," Wayne said.
"What do you want for the book?"
The man regarded him.
"It's not for trade."
"I've got this here nice wallet,"
Wayne said, holding it up, water dripping out the side.
"Recently cleaned." "Move along, sir," the man said. "I am not—"
"How about this?"
Wayne said, yanking out the knife. The man jumped back in alarm, dropping his notebook. Wayne snatched it, dropping the knife.
"Great trade.
Thanks.
Bye."
He took off at a dash.
"Hey!"
the man shouted, chasing after him.
"Hey!"
"No trade backs,"
Wayne shouted, hand on his wet hat, running for all he was worth.
"Come back here!"
Wayne dashed out onto the main street along the canal, passing a couple of old men sitting on a tenement's steps near the entrance to the slums.
"That's Edip's boy," one of them said. "Always getting himself into trouble, that one is."
The man got hit in the face by a meat bun a second later. Wayne ignored that, holding his hat to his head and running all out. The conner was a determined one. Followed Wayne a good 10 streets before slowing, then stopping, hands on his knees. Wayne grinned and ducked around one last corner before slamming his back against the bricks of a building beside a window. He was pretty winded himself.
"He'll probably file a report," Wayne thought. "Hope the fine they make Wax pay ain't too large."
He ought to find something to bring back as an apology. Maybe Wax needed a wallet. Wayne heard something beside him and turned to see a woman with spectacles leaning out the window to look at him curiously. She was holding a pen, and just inside the window a half-finished letter lay on the desk in front of her.
"Perfect."
Wayne tipped his hat, snatching the pen from her hand.
"Thanks,"
he said, opening the notebook and scribbling some words. As she cried out, he tossed the pen back to her, then continued on his way. The final destination, the god's dwelling, was not far now. He veered down a street lined with trees and quaint smaller townhomes. He counted them off, then turned to the right and stood facing it. The god's new temple. She'd moved here a few months ago. He took a deep breath, banishing the music in his head. This had to be quiet. He crept carefully up the long walk to the front door. There, he quietly tucked the book into the spot between the doorknob and the door. He didn't dare knock. Renette was a jealous god, known for shooting people. For her, it was practically a governmental mandate. If the constables didn't find a few corpses on her doorstep every week, they'd start to wonder if she wasn't feeling well. Wayne slipped away. He smiled, imagining Renette's reaction as she opened the door, and was so distracted that he almost ran right into Renette herself walking up the path to her house. Wayne stumbled back. Perfect brown hair pulled back to expose a gorgeous face, weathered from her time in the roughs. A fantastic figure, round in all the right places. Tall. Taller than Wayne. So he had something to look up to.
"Wayne! What were you doing at my door?"
"I..." "Idiot," she said, shoving past him. "You'd better not have broken in. Tell Wax I delivered those cords to him just now. He needn't have sent someone to check on me."
"Cords?" Wayne asked. "What cords?"
She ignored the question, muttering. "I swear I am going to shoot you, you little maggot." He watched her go, smiled to himself, then turned and continued walking away.
"What's this?"
she said from behind him. He kept walking.
"Wayne!"
she shouted at him.
"I'll shoot you, right now! I swear I will! Tell me what you've done!"
He turned around.
"It's just a gift, Renette."
"A notebook?" she asked, flipping the pages. He shoved his hands into his trouser pockets and shrugged.
"Writing book," he said. "You're always writing stuff down, thinking about things. Figured if there's one thing you could always use more of, it's a writing book. All those ideas you have must get pretty crowded up there. Makes sense you'd need places to store them."
"Why is it damp?"
"Sorry," he said. "Forgotten stuck it in my pocket for a moment. But I got it right back out. I fought 10 constables for that, I'll have you know."
She flipped through it, eyes narrowed in suspicion until she reached the last page.
"What's this?"
She held it up close and read the words he'd scrawled on the back page.
"Thank you and goodbye? What's wrong with you?"
"Nothing's wrong," Wayne said. "I just figured it was time."
"You're leaving?"
"For a little, but that's not what the words mean. I'm sure we'll see each other again, perhaps frequently and such. I'll see you, but I won't be seeing you again, see?" She looked at him for a long moment, then seemed to relax.
"You mean it?"
"Yeah."
"Finally. Gotta grow up sometime, right? I've found that, well, a man wanting something don't make it true, you know?"
Renette smiled. Seemed an awful long time since he'd seen her do that. She walked to him, and he didn't even flinch when she extended her hand. He was proud of that. He took her hand, and she raised his, then kissed it on the back.
"Thank you, Wayne."
He smiled, let go, and turned to leave. One step into it, though, he hesitated, then shifted his weight to his other foot and leaned toward her again.
"Marcy says you're courting another girl."
"I am." Wayne nodded.
"Now, I don't want to go wrong, seeing as I'm being so gentlemanly and grown up and the like, but you can't blame a man for getting ideas when hearing something such as that. So, I don't suppose there's a chance for the three of us to..." "Wayne, I don't mind none if she's fat, Renette. I likes a girl what has something to hold on to."
"Wayne?" He looked back at her, noting the storm in her expression.
"Right," he said. "Right. Okay, yeah. I don't suppose when we're looking fondly on this conversationalizing and our memorable farewell, we could both just forget I said that last part?"
"I'll do my best." He smiled, took off his hat, and gave her a deep bow he'd learned off a 6th-generation doorman greeter at Lady Zobel's ballroom in the 4th Octant. Then he stood up straight, replaced his hat, and put his back toward her. He found himself whistling as he went on his way.
"What is that song?"
she called after him.
"I know it."
"The Last Breath," he said without turning back.
"The pianoforte was playing it when we first met."
He turned the corner and didn't look back. Didn't even check if she'd sighted on him with a rifle or something. Feeling a spring in his step, he made his way to the nearest busy intersection and tossed the empty wallet into the gutter. It wasn't long before a carriage for hire pulled up, and its coachman glanced to the side, saw the wallet, and scrambled down to grab it.
Dashing out from an alley, Wayne beat the man to it, diving for the wallet and rolling on the ground.
"It's mine," he said. "I seen it first."
"Nonsense,"
the coachman said, swatting Wayne with his horse reed.
"I dropped it, you ruffian. It's mine."
"Oh, is that so?" Wayne said. "How much is in it?"
"I need not answer to you."
Wayne grinned, holding up the wallet.
"I tells you what. You can have it and everything that's inside. But you take me to the 4th Octant West train station."
The coachman eyed him, then held out his hand. Half an hour later, the coach rolled up to the rail station, a bleak-looking building with peaked towers and tiny windows, as if to taunt those trapped inside with a scant view of the sky. Wayne sat on the back footman's stand, legs swinging over the side. Trains steamed by, rolling up to platforms to gorge themselves on a new round of passengers. Wayne hopped down, tipped his hat to the grumbling coachman, who seemed well aware he'd been had, and strolled in through the open doors. He shoved his hands in his pockets and looked about until he found Wax, Marcy, and Steris standing amid a small hill of suitcases with servants waiting at the ready to carry them.
"Finally," Wax snapped. "Wayne, our train is nearly boarding. Where have you been?"
"Making an offering to a beautiful god," Wayne said,
looking up toward the building's high ceiling.
"Why do you suppose they made this place so big? Ain't like the trains ever come in here, eh?"
"Wayne," Steris asked, wrinkling her nose, "are you drunk?"
He put a bit of a slur into his speech.
"Course not. Why'd I be drunk at this hour?"
He looked at her lazily.
"You're insufferable," she said, waving to her lady's maid. "I can't believe you risked being late for a little liquor."
"Wasn't a little," Wayne said.
When the train arrived, he joined the others in climbing aboard. Steris and Wax had ordered an entire car set aside for the lot of them. Unfortunately, the last-minute hiring meant it had to be hitched all the way at the back, and Wayne had to share a room with Herb, the footman.
Bugger that.
He knew for a fact the man snored. He'd find someplace else to sleep, or else just stay up. The train to New Saren wasn't going to take that long. They'd arrive before sunrise. In fact, as the thing finally started to chug into motion, he swung out his compartment's window, much to Herb's consternation, and climbed up onto the roof. He sat there whistling softly, watching Ellendale pass for a time, wind ruffling his hair. A simple tune, easy and familiar, and the accompanying beat played on the tracks below. Ba-bum, ba-bum, ba-bum. Quick, energetic. He lay down then, staring at the sky, the clouds, the sun. Eyes forward, back turned toward the past. Part 2. 5. Watching the passing scenes, Wax was immediately struck by how populated the land was south of Ellendale. It was easy to forget how many people lived in cities other than the capital. The railway rolled along beside a river wide enough to swallow whole towns up in the roughs. Villages, towns, and even cities sprinkled the route, so common that the train barely went 5 minutes without passing another one. Between the towns, orchards stretched into the distance. Fields of wheat bowed and danced. Everything was green and vibrant, refreshed on evenings when the mists came out. Wax turned from the window and dug into the package Renette had sent him. Inside, in a fitted, plush-lined case, was a large double-barreled shotgun. Beside it, in their own indentations, were three spheres, each wrapped with a thin cord. The spheres and cords he'd expected. The shotgun was a treat. "Experimenting with extra-powerful loads," a note read, "and enormous slugs for stopping thugs or full-blooded coloss. Please test. Will require increased weight on your part to fire. Recoil should be exceptional."
Rust and ruin, the shells for this thing were almost as wide as a man's wrist. It was like a cannon.
He held one up as the train slowed into a station. It wasn't quite dark yet, but windows in the town were bright with electricity.
electric lights. He lowered the shell, studying them. The outer cities had electricity?
Of course they do, idiot,
he immediately thought to himself. Why wouldn't they? He'd fallen into the same trap he'd once mocked others for. He'd started to assume that anything important, trendy, or exciting happened inside Ellendale. That sort of attitude had annoyed him when he'd lived in the roughs. The train yielded a handful of passengers and picked up fewer, which surprised Wax, considering the crowded platform. Were they waiting for another train? He leaned out the side to get a better look out the window. No. The people were clumped together, listening to one of their number shout something Wax couldn't hear. As he strained to read a sign one of the people carried, someone threw an egg, and it splatted right beside his window. He pulled back. The train started up again, having waited only a fraction of the time it normally did at a stop. As it eased out of the station, more eggs flew toward it. Wax finally got a good look at the sign. End Ellendale Oppression. Oppression? He frowned, leaning as the train turned a bend, letting him watch the crowd of people on the platform. A few hopped onto the tracks and shook fists.
Steris, he asked, packing away Renette's box, have you paid attention to the outer city's situation?
No reply came. He glanced toward his fiancée, who still sat across the compartment from him, huddled in her seat with a blanket around her shoulders. She didn't appear to have noticed the stop or the eggs. Her face was stuck so far into her book that snapping it closed would have caught her nose. Landre, the lady's maid, had gone to Reddy Steris's bed, and Wayne was doing who knows what. So the two of them were alone in the room. Steris? No reply. Wax cocked his head, trying to read the spine and make out what had her so fascinated, but she'd wrapped the volume in a cloth cover. He inched to the side and saw that her eyes were wide as she read. She turned the page quickly. Wax frowned, rising and leaning across to get a view of one of the pages. Steris saw him, jumped, and snapped the book closed.
Oh, she said. Did you say something?
What are you reading?
History of Nuseren, Steris said, tucking the book under her arm.
You looked shocked as you read.
Well, I don't know if you realize it, but the name Seren has a very disturbing history. What did you want to ask me?
Wax settled back.
I saw a crowd on the train platform. They seemed angry about Ellendale.
Oh, yes. Let's see. Outer cities, political situation.
She seemed to need a moment to compose herself. What had she read in that history that was so disconcerting?
Well, I'm not surprised to hear of it. They aren't happy for obvious reasons.
You mean the taxation issues? They're that upset?
He looked out the window, but they were too far away now for him to make out the crowd.
We only tax them a little, to maintain infrastructure and government.
Well, they would argue that they don't need our government, as they have their own city administrations. Waxillium, many in the basin feel that Ellendale is trying to act as if our governor were some kind of emperor, something that was supposed to have ended when the Lord Mistborn stepped down after his century of rule.
But our taxes don't pay Governor Aradel, Wax said. They pay for things like constables to police the docks and maintenance of the railway lines.
Technically, that is correct, Steris said. But then, all goods are also taxed when they enter Ellendale using the very railway lines and rivers we maintain. Have you noticed that there are almost no railway lines traveling directly from city to city outside of Ellendale? Other than the interchange at Doriel, everyone wishing to go from one outer city to another must go toward Ellendale. Want to ship something from Elmsdale to Rashikin? Have to pass through Ellendale. Want to sell metals in Tathingdwell? Have to pass through Ellendale.
A hub system makes perfect sense, Wax said.
And it also lets us tax practically all goods shipped throughout the entire basin, Steris said. By outer cities' arguments, that means we're taxing them twice. First, by our levies to maintain the railway lines, then a second time by making them pass everything through us. They've lobbied for years to get some direct lines running around the basin in a loop, and have always been denied.
Huh,
Wax said, settling back.
The rivers are just as bad, Steris said. We don't control where they were placed, of course, but they do all flow toward Elendel, so we control water traffic. There are roadways between towns, but they're horribly inefficient compared to water or rail travel, so Elendel tariffs basically set prices around the basin. We can be certain that any goods produced in the city are never undercut, and can provide incentives for things we don't produce to be sold at a discount in the city. Wax nodded slowly. He'd had an inkling, and had heard about the outer city's complaints, but he'd always read Elendel broadsheets on the matter. To hear it spelled out so directly by Steris made him marvel at his own short-sightedness.
I should have paid more attention. Perhaps I should talk to Aradel about this.
Well, there are reasons Elendel does as it has. Steris set her book aside and stood to get down a piece of luggage. Wax eyed the book, noting that she'd marked her page. He reached toward it, but a sudden jerk by the train sent Steris sitting back down with a thump, and she set her suitcase on the book.
Lord Waxillium?
Sorry. Continue.
Well, the Governor and Senate are trying to maintain a single unified nation in the basin, rather than letting it fracture into a bunch of city-states. They're using the economics to push the outer cities to accept centralized rule in exchange for lowered tariffs. Even Aradel, as a moderate liberal, has accepted that this is good for the basin as a whole. Of course, the noble houses don't care so much about unity as reaping the benefits of a stranglehold on trade.
And I assume I've benefited from these policies?
Benefited? Steris said. You practically thrive on them, Lord Waxillium. Your textiles and metalworks would be undercut dramatically without these tariffs. You voted for maintaining them twice, and for raising them once.
I have?
Well, I have, Steris said. You did tell me to see to your house's interests in voting at—
Yes, I know, Wax said, sighing.
The train rocked on its tracks, rhythmic thumps sounding from below. Wax turned back to the window, but they weren't passing a town at the moment, and everything was growing dark. No mist tonight.
Is something wrong, Lord Waxillium? Steris asked. Whenever we speak of politics or house finances, you grow distant.
It's because I'm a child sometimes, Steris, Wax said. Please continue your instruction. These are things I need to learn. Don't let my foolishness discourage you.
Steris leaned forward and rested her hand on his arm.
These last 6 months have been difficult. You can be excused for letting your attention toward politics lapse.
He continued, looking out the window. Following Lessie's first death, he'd lost himself. He'd determined not to react that way again, and had thrown his attention into working with the constables. Anything to keep him occupied, and to prevent him from lapsing into the same melancholy inactivity that had struck him when he'd first lost her.
I've still been a fool, and maybe there's more. Steris, I've never had a mind for politics, even when I was trying to do my duty. It might be beyond me.
In our months together, I've come to see you as a fiercely intelligent person. The puzzles I've seen you solve, the answers I've seen you tease out, why, they're nothing short of remarkable. You are most certainly capable of caring for your house. Begging your pardon, I'd say it is not your mind, but what you mind, that is the issue.
Wax smiled, looking toward her.
Steris, you're a delight. How could anyone ever think you dull?
But I am dull.
Nonsense.
And when I asked you to help me review my list of preparations for the trip?
That list had been 27 pages long. I still can't believe you got all those things into our bags.
All of—
Steris blinked.
Lord Waxillium, I didn't bring all of those things.
But you made a list.
To think of everything we might need. I feel better when something goes wrong if I've contemplated that it might. At least this way, if we run into something we've forgotten, I can feel good knowing I figured we might need it.
But if you didn't bring all of that stuff, then what is in all those boxes? I saw Herb struggling to lug a few of them up to the train.
Oh, Steris said, opening the suitcase she'd gotten down.
Why, our house finances, of course.
Indeed, inside was a large stack of ledgers.
This trip was unplanned, Steris explained, and I have to prepare an accountability report for the banks by next month. House Ladrian has recovered for the most part from your uncle's spending, but we need to maintain strict books in order to convince lenders we're solvent, so they will be willing to work with us.
We have accountants, Steris, Wax said.
Yes, this is their work, she said. I need to check it over. You can't simply turn in someone else's work without making certain the work was done properly. Besides, they're off 3 clips in this quarter's financials.
3 clips, Wax said. Out of how much money?
5 million.
They're off 300ths of a boxing, Wax said. Out of 5 million? I'd say that's not bad.
Well, it's within the thresholds the banks demand, Steris said. But it's still sloppy. These financials are how we represent ourselves to the world, Lord Waxillium. If you want to overcome the impression people have of House Ladrian and its indulgences, you must agree that we have a responsibility to present ourselves. You're doing it again.
Wax started, sitting up straighter. Excuse me?
Distant look in your eyes, Steris noted. Aren't you the one who is always talking about the responsibility men have to uphold the law?
Different thing entirely.
But your responsibility to your house is why I'm here, Steris, Wax said. Why I came back in the first place. I recognize it. I acknowledge it. You just don't like it.
A man doesn't have to like his duty. He just has to do it.
She clasped her hands in her lap, studying him. Here, let me show you something.
She rose, reaching for another suitcase on the rack above her seat. Wax took her moment of distraction as a chance to slip the book she'd been reading out from its hiding place. He flipped forward to the page she'd marked, curious to discover exactly what about New Saren had captivated her so. He was completely shocked, then, when the page didn't contain a historical description, but instead anatomy sketches, along with long descriptions explaining human reproduction? The room grew very still. Wax glanced up to find Steris staring at him with a look of horror on her face. She went beet red and dropped to her seat, covering her face with her hands and groaning loudly. Wax said. I guess,
I think I'm going to throw up, Steris said.
I didn't mean to pry, Steris. You were just acting so odd and so fascinated by what was in the book. She groaned again. Wax sat, awkward in the shaking train car, searching for words. So, you don't have any experience in these matters, I assume?
I keep asking for details, Steris said, slumping back into her seat and leaning her head back against the wall, looking up at the ceiling. But nobody will tell me anything. You'll figure it out, they say with a wink and a grin. The body knows what to do. But what if mine doesn't? What if I do it wrong?
You could have asked me.
Because that wouldn't be embarrassing,
Steris said, closing her eyes.
I know the basics. I'm not an idiot. But I need to provide an heir. It's vital. How am I supposed to do this properly if I don't have any information? I tried to interview some prostitutes about it.
Wait, you did?
Yes. A trio of very nice ladies. Met them for tea. But they clammed up the moment they discovered who I was. They even got strangely protective, and wouldn't give me any details either. I get the impression they thought I was cute. What about being a spinster could possibly be cute? Do you realize I'm almost 30?
1 foot in the grave, obviously, Wax said.
It's easy to joke when you're a man, she snapped. You're not in a deadline to provide something useful to this arrangement.
You're worth more than your ability to bear children, Steris.
That's right. There's my money, too.
And all I am to this arrangement is a title, Wax said. It goes both ways.
Steris settled back, breathing in and out through her teeth for a few moments. Finally, she cracked one eye.
You can shoot things, too.
What every proper lady needs in a man.
Murdering is very traditional. Goes all the way back.
Wax smiled.
Actually, if you want to be strictly traditional, going back to the imperial pair, it was the lady in the relationship who did the murdering.
Either way, I apologize for my tirade. It was completely uncalled for. I shall endeavor to be firmer with myself following our union.
Don't be silly, Wax said. I like seeing moments like this from you.
You like it when ladies are in distress?
I like it when you show me something new. It's good to remember that people have different sides.
Well, she said, taking the book, I can continue my research at another point. Our wedding has been delayed, after all.
This was to be the night, he realized. Our first night of marriage. He'd known, of course, but thinking about it made him feel... what? Relieved? Sad? Both? If it eases your mind, Wax said as she tucked the book into her suitcase, we won't need to be... involved with any real frequency, particularly once a child is provided. I don't imagine your research will be necessary for more than a dozen or so occasions.
As he said it, she wilted, shoulders slumping, head bowing. She was still facing away from him, digging in her suitcase, but he spotted it immediately.
Damn. That had been a stupid thing to say, hadn't it? If Leslie had been here, she'd have stomped on his toe for that one. He felt sick, then cleared his throat. That was injudicious of me, Steris. I'm sorry.
The truth should never be the wrong thing to say, Lord Waxillium, she said, straightening and looking toward him, composed once again. This is exactly as our arrangement was to be, as I know full well. I did write the contract.
Wax crossed the train car, then sat next to her, resting his hand on hers.
I don't like this talk from you. Or from me. It's become a habit for us to pretend this relationship is nothing more than titles and money. But, Steris, when Lissy died...
He choked off, then took a deep breath before continuing.
Everyone wanted to talk to me, speak at me, blather about how they knew what I was feeling. But you just let me weep, which was what I needed more than anything. Thank you.
She met his eyes, then squeezed his hand.
What we are together, Wax said to her, and what we make of our future need not be spelled out by a piece of paper.
Or, well, a large stack of them.
The contract need not set our bounds.
Pardon, but I thought that was exactly the purpose of a contract, to define and set bounds.
And the purpose of life is to push our bounds, Wax said. To shatter them, escape them.
An odd position, Steris said, cocking her head. For a lawman?
Not at all, Wax said.
He thought for a moment, then crossed to his side of the chamber again and dug into Renette's box, getting out one of the metal spheres wound with a long cord.
Do you recognize this?
I noticed you looking at it earlier.
Wax nodded.
Third version of her hook device, like the one we used to climb Zobel Tower. Watch.
He burned steel and pushed on the sphere. It leaped from his fingers, streaking toward the bar in the luggage rack, trailing the cord behind, which he held in his hand. As the sphere reached the rack, Wax pushed on a specific thin blue line, revealed by his allomantic senses. It pointed to a latch hidden inside the sphere, like the one inside Vindication that turned off the safety. A hidden set of hooks deployed from the sphere. He tugged the cord, and was pleased to find that it locked into place, catching on the luggage rack.
Way more handy than the other designs, Wax thought, impressed.
He pushed on the switch a second time, and the mechanism disengaged, retracting the hooks with a snap. The ball fell to the couch beside Steris, and Wax pulled it into his hand by the cord.
Clever,
Steris said.
And this relates to the conversation, how?
Wax pushed on the sphere again, but this time didn't engage the mechanism. Instead, he held the cord tight, giving the sphere about 3 feet of line. It jerked to a stop in midair, hovering. He kept pushing, upward and away from him at an angle, but also held the cord, and that kept the sphere from falling.
People, Wax said, are like cords, Steris. We snake out, striking this way and that, always looking for something new. That's human nature, to discover what is hidden. There's so much we can do, so many places we can go.
He shifted in his seat, changing his center of gravity, which caused the sphere to rotate upward on its tether.
But if there aren't any boundaries, he said, we get all tangled up. Imagine 1,000 of these cords zipping through the room. The law is there to keep us from ruining everyone else's ability to explore. Without law, there's no freedom. That's why I am what I am.
And the hunt?
Steris asked, genuinely curious.
That doesn't interest you?
Sure it does, Wax said, smiling. That's part of the discovery, part of the search. Find who did it, find the secrets, the answers.
There was, of course, another part, the part Miles had forced Wax to admit. There was a certain perverse anger that lawmen directed at those who broke the law, almost a jealousy. How dare these people escape? How dare they go the places nobody else was allowed to? He let the sphere drop, and Steris picked it up, looking it over with a meticulous eye.
You talk about answers, secrets, and the search. Why is it you hate politics so much?
Well, it might be because sitting in a stuffy room and listening to people complain is the opposite of discovery.
No, Steris said. Every meeting is a mystery, Lord Waxillium. What are their motives? What quiet lies are they telling? And what truths can you discover?
She tossed his sphere back to him, then took her suitcase and set it on the small cocktail table in the center of the cabin.
House finances are the same.
House finances, he said flatly.
Yes,
Steris said. She fished in the suitcase, getting out a ledger.
See? Look.
She flipped it open and pointed at an account. He looked at the page, then up at her.
Such excitement, he thought. But ledgers? 3 clips, he said. The tables are different by 3 clips. I'm sorry, Steris. It's a meaningless amount. I don't see...
It's not meaningless,
she said, scooting over to sit beside him.
Don't you see? The answer is here, somewhere, in this book. Aren't you even curious? The mystery of where they went?
She nodded to him, excited.
Well, I suppose you could show me how to look, he said. He dreaded the idea, but then she looked so happy.
Here,
she said, handing him a ledger, then fishing out another.
Look at goods received. Compare the dates and the payouts to the ledger. I'm going to study maintenance.
He glanced toward the window in their door, half expecting Wayne to be out there in the hallway, snickering himself senseless at the prank. But Wayne was not there. This was no prank. Steris grabbed her own ledgers and attacked them with as much ferocity as a hungry man might a good steak. Wax sighed, sat back, and started looking through the numbers.
Upper Left Quadrant of the Broadsheet, The New Ascendancy, Volume 6, Number 220, New Saren, 8th of Cladence, 342. 2 clips. Alamancer Jack presents Nikki Savage, Paranatural Detective in The Constructs of Antiquity. When a thief steals a large map of New Saren, Ms. Savage is on the case. The map's secret pocket contains her father's parting gift to her, the location of a tribe of metal beings, the Kalkis, lost creations of the Lord Ruler. Currently, the only one keeping our daring debutante from the secrets of the unknown constructs of antiquity is the magical burglar she calls the Haunted Man. Part 2. The Ghastly Gondola.
I arrived just as the gondola doors slammed shut, and the whole conveyance lurched away.
Behind the glass doors, the haunted man smiled, the green glow of his devices lighting him from below. I ran alongside the car, matching pace with it, while at the same time digging out my trusty little bottle of chromium for a quick swig. Warmth rose from my stomach to my throat, and so did my confidence. As the car slid away from the dock, I leapt into the air. Continued below the fold. Broken gondola strands passengers. An unidentified disturbance halted the Zinc Line yesterday evening about sunset, according to the New Saren Transportation Authority. The NSTA carried passengers home the old-fashioned way, on donkeys and rickshaws down the switchbacks. We see this as proof for the need of a backup emergency transport system. Continued on back. Bilming's newest ships amuse Ellendel officials. A week ago, Bilming's Lord Mayor Bastian Severington stood at the city's impressive harbor and greeted high-ranking officials and noble persons of the Ellendel Senate. Like the peaceable tortoise, symbol of Bilming's great city, Governor Severington's gracious invitation to Ellendel's elite has been seen as a gesture of friendship and unity. More impressive than the harbor are the rows of ships docked there. Most are the usual familiar clippers and cargo ships, but among them float metal beasts like sharks among turtles. These are the warships developed by Lord Mayor Severington and the late Dr. Florin Mallon, predecessor to the Basin's current Minister of Science and Technology. Each ship carries 8 12-inch twin guns, with each turret having a range of 16 miles, said Severington. Other improvements include reinforced armor hulls, electrical rangefinders, and a top speed of 24 miles an hour. We call them pewter knots. But some members of Ellendel's delegation were not impressed. What an amusing display of toys, said Senator Ines Julian. Why do we need warships? The basin is alone on land and on the seas. From whom do we need protection? Continued on back. Now playing at the Uptown Trio Theater, The Den of the Survivor. A crew of freedom fighters rise up against oppression and overthrow a corrupt government.